Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor yourself, just go to our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon donor. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, where we are going back to the year 1982, 40 years ago, and talking about all the big events that happened in the world of bodybuilding. So last week on the show, Jerry and I talked about the year 1982, and that was part one of our interview. And we talked about all the big amateur events that happened in 1982, including the very first MPC Nationals, which at the time was called the American Bodybuilding Championships, and also the 1982 AAU Mr. America. So in 1982, 40 years ago, that was the first time that the AAU and the MPC split off. In fact, it was the first year that the MPC officially started, and Lee Haney won the very first MPC Nationals, which again at the time was called, they wanted to call it the MPC Mr. America, but they went to court. The MPC and AAU actually went to court, and the AAU won the injunction, and they were allowed to use the title Mr. America, and the MPC had to call their contest something different, so that's why they called it the American Bodybuilding Championships, which in 1983, 1 year later, they started calling the MPC Nationals, the National Physique Committee, obviously called their contest the MPC Nationals. So we talked about all those shows last week, and now this week on the show, we are going to talk about the professional events that happened in 1982, including, of course, the Mr. Olympia contest, which was won by Chris Dickerson, 43 years old, and this was Chris's big contest win of his career. And Chris had taken second the last 2 years when Arnold Schwarzenegger and Franco Colombo won, and then he retired, actually only retired for about a year. And he did come back in 1984, but he didn't do that well. So this was pretty much the highlight of Chris Dickerson's career. So we're going to talk about the 1982 Mr. Olympia contest. We're also going to talk about the Night of the Champions contest that took place that May in New York. And that was won by Albert Beckles. And that contest was pretty notable because it was the IFBB debut of Bertle Fox, who was talked about very much in the magazines at that time because he had already won the NAVA Mr. Universe like two or three times, and now he was finally coming over to the IFBB. And we will also talk about the IFBB World Professional Championships, which was held, I believe, in Atlantic City that year, and that was also won by Albert Beckles. So Albert Beckles had a fantastic year in 1982. He won the two big professional events, and then he took fifth place at the Mr. Olympia, which we'll talk about. So we got a lot to talk about with Jerry about the year 1982, 40 years ago. I will be heading off to Maui. In fact, by the time you hear this podcast, I will probably be on my way to Maui, Hawaii. I'm going to spend a week out there with my parents and my brother and his family. So it should be a great family trip. And we will hopefully be back on the show next week with another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. But I will be out there for the next week. And while I'm out there, I'm going to try and look up Mario Saline. Those who were around in the 1980s remember Mario Saline. She was one of the best female bodybuilders in the world at the time. Very beautiful lady. I think she's from Finland. And her husband, Hanu, they own a gym out in Maui. So when I was out there last time, about 3 years ago in 2020, I went and checked out their gym and I got to meet them. And just by coincidence, Hanu called me up out of the blue last week and he said, hey, if you're ever in Maui again, come by and see the gym. And I told him I'll be out there next week. So that was really wild that he called me just out of the blue. I haven't talked to him in like 3 years since I've been there last. So I will be going out to Hanu and Mario Saline's gym again out in Maui. And I'm going to go check them out and talk to them. I'm trying to get Mario to come on the show, but she didn't want to do it last time. So hopefully she'll change her mind. We got a couple emails I want to read. Before I get to that, I want to talk about the Arnold Classic. That's the big news in bodybuilding this week. They came out with the official list of the Arnold Classic, and it only had about 7 competitors, which is unbelievable. The Arnold Classic is an invitation-only show, and they usually invite 15 of the world's top bodybuilders. And there's usually a few good bodybuilders who are left off the list because they only invite 15, unlike the Olympia, where anybody who is qualified to enter the Olympia can enter. And I think this year at the Olympia, they had about 30 competitors on stage. So the Arnold Classic is usually a very prestigious show. It's usually the second biggest contest of the year behind the Olympia. And it has been going on since 1989. And I have never heard of a year where they only had about 6 or 7 competitors. And since they announced that official list, a couple of the competitors have dropped out. So a couple of things have happened this week. First of all, they had a prize money of $200,000 for first place, which I think is the highest they've ever offered. And they raised it this week to $300,000 to try to get some of the top-level bodybuilders. And they did. Just today it was announced that Nick Walker, who won the Arnold Classic a couple years ago, he is going into the contest again. He just took third place at the Mr. Olympia. So, of course, Nick is going to be the favorite going in. I also heard Big Ramy, who was a 2-time Mr. Olympia winner, and he just lost the title. He took 5th place in December. He might be going into it. And I also heard a rumor that Derek Lunsford might be going in it as well. So we will see what happens. But these guys would be crazy not to do it since there's only really just a handful of competitors. So should be interesting to see what happens with that. We are now in the year 2023. I hope your new year is going good. If you guys are trying to get in shape, the company that I work for, Pro Physique, I think I mentioned this last week, they are having a transformation challenge, which is a 3-month challenge where you have to submit your pictures, your before pictures, and you have 3 months to get into shape. You don't need to use a Pro Physique coach. I have a coach there. And you can just do it on your own, or you could hire a coach. They actually have a thing now called a guided coach where you could hire a coach for 3 months at a reduced price, and they will help you get in shape, and they will just consult with you on your diet, and you will check in with them every 2 weeks over the 15-week challenge. So anyways, the first date of the show was supposed to be January 9th, and now they have moved it up 2 weeks to January 23rd. So if you're interested in entering, you can enter it in the next 2 weeks. And I think it's $50,000 in prize money. So if you feel like you have a chance to motivate yourself and get in great shape and have a big change from your before to after pictures, you might want to check it out. It's only $50 to enter. Just go to prophysique.com. I got the direct link on the description below if you want to check it out. And you can use me as a coach if you want. Otherwise, you can just do it yourself. All right. I did get a couple emails. If you guys are interested in emailing me about the show, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I'll read your email on the air. This first one says, "Hello, Mr. Hansen. I enjoy your podcast on Spotify very much. Well done with the interesting guests and history. I was wondering if you had released Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 2. Thank you, John G." No, John, I have not released that yet. I should get to work on that, I guess. It's been a couple of years since we released the first one. But yeah, I've been working on my other book, The History of Bodybuilding, and I've been working on that every week. So slowly getting through the years on that one. So no, I have not done that yet, but maybe I will get to that sometime later this year. This email says, "Hey, John, I love the show. When you're struggling for interviews, why don't you just do a few shows just reading the magazine articles? They are great to listen to. Regards, Gareth Hudson." That's a great idea. I might do that next week, Gareth, because I don't think we have an interview lined up yet. I did not interview Jerry yet about the year 1992, which is the last one we have to cover when we do our history of bodybuilding at the end of the year. So maybe I'll do that next week. That's a great idea. And I've got plenty of magazines. Man, I have tons of them. And I'm sure a lot of you guys have never heard of a lot of these magazines or never seen them. So there's a lot to draw from. I got Muscle Builder magazines. I got Iron Man magazines. I got Muscular Development. So some of the stuff from Iron Man and, of course, Muscle Builder is really, really great stuff. And then I also got an email from one of my former competitors, Pete Miller, who was from Chicago. He said, "Hey, John, I just listened to the podcast with Dave DeYoung and Larry Bernstein. Great stuff. Good old days relived. And he was talking about Dave DeYoung, who was the owner of Quad's Gym in Chicago. Probably owned that gym for about 40 years. And I believe Pete used to train there. And Pete was a fantastic bodybuilder. He won the AAU Mr. America in 1990. I competed against Pete at the 1990, the same year. I think it was like 2 weeks before he won the America, at the MPC Illinois Cup. And Pete went into that contest as a warm-up, and he won the heavyweights. And overall, I was a light heavyweight that year. That was the first time I went down to light heavyweight. I used to compete as a heavyweight back then in the 80s, but I was a lighter heavyweight. I was about 205, 5'8". So for one time, I tried to go down to light heavyweight, and I went down to 198. And Pete was about 218 at my height. So that shows you how big he was. He was fantastic. Unbelievable leg development. So Pete was a really great guy, really nice guy. And like I said, he went on to win the Mr. America. And then after that, he quit bodybuilding. He never went on to try to become an IFBB pro or anything. And now he is a school teacher out in Chicago. And so much time has gone by since that contest. I can't believe when he told me this. He said he is getting ready to retire from his teaching position because he's been doing it for about 25 years. So, wow, 1990. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but I was 27. I think Pete was only 23 because when I won the MPC Illinois Bodybuilding Championships when I was 23, Pete was only 19 because Pete won the Teenage Illinois that year. So we were 4 years apart, but he was a fantastic bodybuilder. I'm telling you, his leg development was probably some of the best in the country that year. So I'm glad he's doing well. I'm glad his health is doing well. And congratulations to him on a whole career of teaching school. So that's awesome. It's good to hear from him. All right. When we finish our interview with Jerry, I am going to read two articles, and they both pertain to the 1982 Mr. Olympia. Of course, that was the biggest show of the year. The first one is from the March 1983 issue of Iron Man magazine. And this was from Gary Bartlett, our friend from Canada. We have had Gary on the show. Gary was one of the top writers and photographers from Canada, and he contributed a lot to Iron Man, but he also was a good friend of Bob Kennedy, and he contributed a lot to Muscle Mag International. The other article is going to come from the very first issue of Flex magazine, which was the April 1983 issue, and this was the very first time they introduced Flex magazine to the world, and Chris Dickerson, of course, is on the cover. He's giving his victory sign on the cover of the magazine, holding his Mr. Olympia trophy, which, by the way, was not a Sandow trophy. They did give Chris a Sandow trophy later on, but this was kind of looks like a NABBA Mr. Universe trophy. And the contest that year was promoted by Oscar State from England. So for some reason, they did not have a Sandow. But anyways, this article was written by Bill Dobbins. So they're both Mr. Olympia reports of Chris Dickerson winning the 1982 Mr. Olympia. So I will read both of those articles when we get finished with our interview with Jerry Branum. So without any further ado, guys, here we go. Here is our interview, part two of our interview, where Jerry and I talk about the year 1982 and bodybuilding. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have my good friend Jerry Branum joining us again this week, and we are continuing our discussion of the history of bodybuilding. So we're going back 40 years from 2022. We're going all the way back to 1982, and this is part two of our interview. In part one of our interview, Jerry and I talked about all the amateur competitions that year, which was all the MPC shows and all the AAU shows, because 1982 was the first year where they split up into the AAU and the MPC. So it was kind of an historic year in bodybuilding. But today we're going to talk about the professional competitions in the IFBB. So we're going to talk about the Mr. Olympia and the Night of the Champions, because that was pretty much about it for the professional shows back then. This was before the Arnold Classic started. Mm-hmm. So, Jerry, let's start our discussion with 1982 Mr. Olympia, which was won by Chris Dickerson.
Right. Yeah. Chris, of course, had tried to win several times before.
Yeah.
Oh, do I have that right? I know he was in an 80. I don't know. Was he in 79? No. He wasn't.
Yeah, 79 was his first Mr. Olympia. Okay. That was his first time competing in the IFBB because he had always been an AAU NABBA guy.
That's right. Yeah.
So he got sixth place in his first Olympia, which was pretty good. And then he got second place 2 years in a row when Arnold won and Franco won. And a lot of people felt like Those were controversial shows, so he could have won. So
yeah,
kind of like paid him off, or not paid him off, but they rewarded his loyalty. He finally won in 1982.
And of course, he was the oldest Mr. Olympia up to that time. And you said he was 43 years old, right? 43?
Yeah, 43, I believe.
And Chris, of course, had a couple other things. He was the first black AAU Mr. America. He broke the barrier.
Yeah. You
know, that was in 1970. He beat a lot of top guys. I knew Chris very well. You know, I met him way back in 1964.
Wow.
Before anyone had ever known him. I was training at a gym called the Mid-City Health Club in Manhattan. And Bill Pearl was my bodybuilding idol at the time. I was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner of the gym told me there was a guy coming in from California who trained at Bill Pearl's gym. And I got all excited because I figured I could ask this guy about Bill Pearl. Well, it turned out to be Chris Dickerson, right? And sure enough, he was wearing a T-shirt and it said Bill Pearl's gym on it. And,
oh, wow.
So I went up to him and said, hey, my name's Jerry. Can you mind if I ask you some questions about Bill Pearl and this and that? And, you know, we talked for a couple of minutes. He's a very nice guy. And he was wearing shorts. After about 10 minutes, I didn't even notice. I looked and I saw his calves.
Yeah.
I was mind-boggled. I'd never seen calves like that, you know?
Yeah.
I said, holy Toledo, what do you do for those calves? He says, nothing. He says, I was born this way. He says, I have two other brothers with triplicates. He said, my brother's a ballet dancer who has bigger calves than me, you know? And right after that, Chris started winning a number of shows in California, AAU shows.
Yeah, yeah.
California, this and that, you know, USA, I don't remember which ones. But then he, of course, as you said, he went into the IFBB, became a top pro. And, you know, a lot of people, it kind of annoys me because they'll look at Chris Dickerson and a lot of people say, well, he was the worst Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's fair because, first of all, yeah, he didn't have the biggest arms, right? You know, but Chris didn't win on the strength of any particular body part, even his calves. The thing about Chris was he had absolutely almost perfect symmetry and balance. And when he stood relaxed, everything was put together perfectly. He had abs, very tight around the waist, beautiful thigh shape, the big calves. When he had a good back and he knew how to pose, he had everything going for him that really was the essence of bodybuilding. So, you know, he didn't have the monstrous things like the big arms that go on. So people think he's and he wasn't a huge guy. He was like 5'6", 5'7".
Yeah.
You know, but what you don't understand is he had a very finished physique. He was very professional in how he competed, how he stood. I mean, I think he was a great Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he was a fantastic bodybuilder. And over the years, when I look at photos of Chris, I've come to appreciate his physique even more.
Yeah, because me too.
He has there's nothing missing. He has everything. I mean, the arms, like I say, maybe a little deficient on the biceps, but he had a great tricep. If you remember his side tricep.
Side tricep was amazing, yeah.
Great tricep. He's a little deficient on the bicep, but so what? I mean, he had great delts. He had everything. I think he was a very deserving winner of the Olympia that year.
Yeah.
I mean, just as a human being, just a fantastic. I mean, he could have told me that when I went up to him in the gym when I was 14, he could have easily said, hey, kid, get lost. I'm busy.
Yeah.
He could have said that, but he stood and talked to me for an hour.
You were 14.
14 years old. Yeah. And I when he got the award at Muscle Beach a couple of years ago, you know, he was older and he had trouble walking. He had a cane. I sat with him. I said, hey, Chris, do you remember when we met way back in 1964 at Mid-City? He says, yeah. He says, I do remember. I said, Chris, I want to thank you again for having the patience to let me talk to you. You know, even though I was just some New York kid, you know, wasting your time, I really appreciate that. He says it's okay. You know? Just a sweet, nice guy, really nice guy.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Jerry, because I totally agree with you. You know, like I said, I'm doing this book on the history of bodybuilding, so I've been buying all these old magazines, and now I'm seeing pictures of Chris, like when he first started in the 1960s. And he was doing local shows, and then he rose up pretty quick. He was winning national level shows after only a couple of years.
That's true.
But you're right. He just had this perfect balance and such great symmetry, and all the muscles were developed evenly. He really had an amazing physique. And it disturbs me too when people say,
you know, this guy's the worst Mr. Olympia. These kids who are saying this, they have no idea his history. You know?
Yeah.
No. They don't know. This guy's won probably 30 titles.
That's right.
And all the – in AAU, in NAVA, in WBBG. You don't – that's not an accident. You don't win all those titles by accident, you know.
And he beat guys that were bigger than him, too, because they had better symmetry and proportion. He beat guys that had much bigger arms than him. And he deserved to beat him because he had the better balanced physique.
Yeah.
Bodybuilding is supposed to be about balance.
Yeah.
Symmetry proportions, where all the muscles tie in and you have the right shape, you have the right structure. That's what bodybuilding is supposed to be. Not some monstrous guy with big arms and lousy legs or lacking a leg bicep or that type of thing. That's not bodybuilding to me. Go ahead.
He did have mass, too, because I remember when I was at that 79 Olympia, which was his first one, and I had been reading about Chris for years in the magazines. You know, I read about he won the America. I saw all the Mr. Universe titles he won in NABBA. And he never did an IFBB show before, so I had never seen him before. And when I saw him, the first thing I thought, and I was only a teenager, but I was thinking, I know why this guy won so many titles looking at him, because you could see the quality, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when he turned to the back, his traps just were coming up to the middle of his neck. He had that thickness in his back. Right. And I'm like, wow, this guy's got a great physique. You know, you could tell.
And another thing to consider is that, you know, even though Chris did look good in photographs, to really appreciate Chris Dickerson's physique, you had to see him in person.
Yeah.
That's when you really – and I saw him in person many times when he was in top shape. And I'm telling you, when he stood up in the lineup, when he stood with the other guys, he stood out.
You could
say that guy's going to win right off the bat. He had everything. And I'm not just talking about because, you know, he had better calves than everybody. He just had the whole complete physique except for the body.
And you mentioned his posing, too. His posing was fantastic.
Beautiful posing. We worked with Bill Pearl on that. You know, he had a great, very smooth posing routine. And his skin tone was good.
Yeah.
He was a black man, but his skin color was almost perfect for bodybuilding. You know what I mean? It just really displayed his muscles well. It just looked everything. He looked like just like a – he was a true champion. It's the best
thing. Almost an olive color.
Olive color, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It just – you know, he was like almost made for bodybuilding, this guy.
Yeah, he was. I remember when I interviewed him, he told me that when he started training, he started growing right away. You know? Right.
Yeah. If you ever look at the, do you ever see that shot of him right when he first began?
With the huge calves?
Yeah, he had these freaky little calves, but literally nothing else.
Nothing, yeah.
He had a string bean body, no arms, no chest, very narrow, nothing. You know, but he still had the giant calves. I mean, when you look at that and you look at what he became, it's just nothing less than remarkable, the amount of muscle he put on himself.
Yeah.
And it's
so funny how fate works, too, because I don't know what got him into bodybuilding, but he said he wanted to start training. And it just so happens that Bill had opened up a gym in California that was like two blocks from his house.
Right.
And he didn't have a car. So he looked it up. I don't know if he found it in the Yellow Pages or what.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was in the newspaper. Maybe there was an ad. Right. And then he was able to walk to the gym. Right. And it just so happens his trainer at his first gym is Bill Pearl, you know.
Right. But yeah. That was on Manchester Boulevard.
You're right.
That's it. He lucked out with there, you know.
Yeah. And I remember he told me a story. He had no training at all, no training experience. So Bill gave him an exercise routine where he was training every body part in one workout, you know, the whole body.
Yeah.
So he had to do three sets of 10 on wide grip chin-ups. And he could only do one. So he had to do basically 30 sets of one rep.
Jeez. Wow.
And I remember the guys were making fun of him, like, are you still here? Are you still at the chinning bar?
That's funny.
He said he trained everything. He trained his neck. He trained his forearms. He trained his calves. He trained, you know, Bill Pearl had trained everything, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bill Pearl was really big on training forearms, too.
Yeah.
Chris, he had to I get very annoyed when people say that he was, you know, the worst. That's bullshit. He's not the worst Mr. Olympia.
Yeah. Not and you mentioned his what a gentleman he was and his personality.
Really
and I think a lot of that comes from Bill Pearl, you know, because
true.
I think he's emulating his idol or his teacher, you know.
Yeah, Bill Pearl was his mentor, and, you know, Bill Pearl basically kind of coached him on how to act also.
Yeah.
And you can see it rubbed off. Chris Dickerson was – there's no way you could not like Chris Dickerson. Let me put it out. He was the most likable guy. There's no way you could say, oh, this guy's an arrogant son of a – but you can never say that. I could say it about a lot of other people that I've been bodybuilding, not Chris Dickerson.
Yeah.
Just a super nice guy.
And I think the fact that he was such a gentleman and so professional, too, was probably pretty instrumental in him winning the first Mr. America, you know, because he was the first, I mean, the first black man to win a Mr. America.
Yeah, yeah, because he was very well-spoken.
Yeah.
He had a great speaking voice. For crying out loud, the man sang opera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He had an opera voice.
Yeah.
You know, and he sounded intelligent. Chris never sounded dumb. He was well-versed. So, you know, I guess the AAU official said, okay, we're going to have to give it to a black guy sooner or later.
Yeah.
Let's give it to this guy because he's got all the qualities that we like.
Yeah.
And that probably, like you say, it probably played into why he was the first black Mr. America.
One of the magazines I read, I think it was the Muscular Development, they said that the AAU would hold this, like, picnic every summer, you know. And I think it was Bob Hoffman's birthday. And Chris Dickerson sang Bob Hoffman happy birthday song.
Yes, yeah.
And that was the year before he won it.
Yeah. I guess Hoffman gave his okay for Dickerson to, you know, to break this glass ceiling, whatever you want to call it, you know. Well, that, I guess that applies more to women, but still.
Yeah.
You know, break the color barrier.
The color barrier, yeah.
Yeah.
His whole cultural upbringing, you know, with being with the arts and opera and all that, and recognizing all that, I think it really paid off for him as a bodybuilder because he brought that class to bodybuilding, you know, and it showed in his posing and the way he conducted himself on stage. I remember reading a contest report written by Rick Wayne, and it was one of those Grand Prix shows that Chris won. And they said he was standing in the lineup and people were, I think it was in New York. So people were saying stuff to him, you know, and it said it like he didn't even hear it. He just stood there. He was so focused on the contest. He just stood like a, you know, like a class act all the way, you know.
He's a class act and he was a professional.
Yeah.
He was the way a professional should act.
Yeah.
I mean, he had, any way you look at it, he had everything together as a lead bodybuilder. A lot of people should take a lesson for, and you know, you'd show up, you'd see him, he'd wear a suit.
Yeah.
He was elegant. You know what I mean? A lot of bodybuilders can take a lesson from Chris Dickerson on how to act in public. If you really want to change the reputation, instead of like, you know, like some guys did at this Olympia, I won't mention names, where, you know, this guy, you know, is sarcastic to another guy right on the stage. The guy gives him a bag and he throws it on the ground. That doesn't look good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, somebody watching that who doesn't know about bodybuilding would say, what is this? What bodybuilders are?
Yeah.
Is that the personality? You know, they get turned off.
I hate that press conference they do at the Olympia. It's just,
I don't like it either.
They're trying to make these guys like wrestlers or MMA or it's not wrestling. It's not MMA. It's bodybuilding.
Well, you know, Chicarella tries to get this, you know, he tries to make it exciting in his mind. He is trying to make it like pro wrestling. He wants the guys to start putting each other down and you have no chance to beat me and you looked fat and this and that.
Yeah.
That's dumb.
Yeah.
That's stupid. I don't know whether Chicarella does that on his own or he's told to do that.
I think that's probably what they're trying to do, you know.
Because I can tell you that when I covered the contest for Weider, when I went to the Mr. Olympia, Chicarella wasn't there. It was held more or less like a regular. There was no put downs. The guys would, you know, sit on a dais, and you know they would just whoever was the MC would say, well, what do you think is going to happen this year? But they didn't rip each other apart. They just said, well, I think I'm in my best shape. I put on 12 pounds, that kind of stuff. You know, they didn't rip up. You know, this all started with the Chicarella stuff, where they try to turn it into a pro wrestler. This guy, I'm going to slaughter him. Blah 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 blah. It's disgusting. I don't like to see
it. Dave Palumbo made a good point. He said, and I said this too, I go, it's a press conference, but there's no press there.
There's no press there. Right.
That's another, you know?
One of my favorite, I remember at one press conference, Dorian Yates was the current Mr. Olympia. They held the press conference. And I'm trying to remember the exact words. Tegan was there. Tegan Clive. She asked Dorian Yates. She noticed he was chewing gum. So he said, she said something like, I can't remember whether it's what brand of gum do you chew, or and Dorian Yates gave this very kind of funny answer. He was really fast on his feet, like, you know.
Yeah, he was. Yeah,
I can't remember what it was. It was a very funny. The whole audience cracked up. That was fun. It was funny, you know, when that kind of thing happened, but not the nastiness.
Well, Dave Palumbo said they should have all the bodybuilding press there, all the different outlets. You know, there's no magazines anymore, but have the different, the bigger podcasts, I guess, and have a representative from it. And they'll all have questions, and then have all the guys up on a dais, like you said, and then they could ask people the questions, you know, and it'll be like a real press conference.
That would be a real preference. That would make more sense instead of this.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, when you think about it, it's needless. You don't need to have any rivalry crap.
Plus, I don't think the competitors like it. They're getting ready to compete in a couple days or a day later, and they're all, you know, piped up, and they don't want to go up on stage and start putting people down and have to deal with all that stress. They don't want to deal with that shit.
That's exactly right. I mean, and not only that, it's not like a martial arts thing or boxing.
MMA or,
where it's a physical there's no need to have this insult party going. It's, you know, each guy's posing individually. Yes, they pose standing against it for comparisons.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're not really engaging physically.
No, they're not going to knock each other out.
Yeah, where you have to attack somebody, you know, verbally. Right. It makes no sense. It's senseless.
Yeah, it is. Plain.
It's childish and stupid, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know? Me too.
You know.
The other thing I want to say about Chris Dickerson was after he retired, he was doing commentary for ESPN and when they were covering bodybuilding on ESPN. And I really liked him as a commentator. I told him that when I interviewed him, you know, because like you said, he had a lot of class and he would comment on all the posing routines and he would even know, like if Muhammad Mukhawi came out and posed to a classical song, Chris knew what the song was, you know,
That's right.
Which I never would have known that, you know. He was trained in the classical music, so he knew all that.
Chris only got mad at me one time. One time. What happened was I wrote a contest report of one of the contests he was in, not that Mr. Olympia, some other pro show, and he wasn't at his best. You know, he didn't win. He wasn't at it. He always placed high, but he
didn't really win. Second,
I remember writing something about, in the magazine, I was describing him, and I said, Chris Dickerson, always a great bodybuilder. He wasn't at his best tonight. He was off. He didn't have his usual Chris definition, you know, something like that. And Chris approached me when the magazine came out, and he was very annoyed about it. He says, he says, I'm really surprised at you, Jerry. I said, what do you mean, Chris? He says, well, you kind of put me down there in the magazine, you know. I said, Chris, I only wrote what I saw. I said, you want me to lie and say that you were at the best shape and should have won? You know, he said, well, I understand. I just, you know, we know each other for so long. I couldn't help being a little hurt. I said, Chris, believe me, it wasn't personal.
Yeah.
I said, I was just acting like an objective reporter. I said, and, you know, I still think you're one of the greatest physiques in the world. And if it offended you, I do apologize. But that wasn't my intention. And we shook hands and never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I promoted like 15 shows, but I did a couple in Tampa from 2014 to 2016. In 2015, I brought Chris out to my contest, and I had him sing the national anthem because he's a singer. Yeah, so that was cool.
Yeah, he did that when he got the Muscle Beach Award. He sang the national anthem.
Oh, no kidding! Wow, that's great.
He was wearing a white suit. Yeah, he came out and sang the national anthem. Yeah.
Yeah.
He did that quite a bit, you know, at contests.
Yeah.
Because of his opera voice. Yeah.
Yeah. So Chris passed away last December, just a little over a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Saddened to hear that. But he had some pretty bad health problems there towards the end. You know?
Yeah. He was, sounded like he was going to be in the hospital for the rest of his life. So maybe it was better that he passed, you know.
You know, John, it gets me how some of these guys are, you know, in such great shape, you know, when they compete, you know, they look healthy and stuff.
Yeah.
And they get older, and it's like they fall apart.
Yeah, it didn't look like he was really training toward the end of his life.
Yeah, I mean, like Chris and Sergio Oliva is another one.
Yeah.
What a tremendous bodybuilder he was. And then towards the end, he was kind of a frail guy.
Hard to see him.
I mean, you know, it just, you know, it's just amazes me to see that. I'm always like shocked that a guy in that kind of physical condition could you know, change to being just like somebody on the street who never lifted weights or did anything exercise. It's very shocking for me to see.
Especially Sergio, because he was so unbelievable.
Yeah, he just wasted away from what
I was. I remember I saw him at what year was that? Probably, well, his son was still an amateur, and he was competing in the Junior Nationals, and it was in Chicago.
Yeah.
So this was probably 2010, maybe, 2009, something like that. Uh-huh. And I was sitting kind of in the back in the auditorium, and it was dark, and I saw somebody walking up the aisle, and you could see he had like earrings, and I could see the metal, the medallion, and I go, oh no, this can't be Sergio, because he was a skinny little old man, you know.
Yeah.
It was just amazing that that monster, that Superman, turned into this skinny little old man, you know.
Yeah, I got another thing. When one year at the Iron Man Pro Show, Mike and Ray Mensa showed up. And Ray was very ill. He had something called Bright's disease, which was he was in kind of a kidney failure situation, and he could barely walk. This guy was such a strong, powerful guy, Ray Mensa, big, strong, you know, and he was, and you know, they're walking up the aisle. He was like barely able to walk. He looked like he was going to, and I just almost was in tears to see that,
because
I knew this guy very well, and
yeah,
I hadn't seen him in a long time. To see him like that was. He died not long after that, but still,
yeah,
so shocking. I mean, I literally was like stunned for like 20 minutes after that. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
you know, such a strong guy to get, you know, get sick like that. It was terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah.
See, people, you got to, these bodybuilders, but have to realize you always have to keep your health in mind, you know, because you can't have big muscles all the way to the end. I mean, the muscles are going to fade away. You got to really keep a focus on health too. Do everything you can to stay healthy. Nutrition, proper exercise, all that stuff. Don't do the bad habits with the cigarette smoking, excess drinking, because it'll catch up with you.
Yeah.
And all your years of being in such great physical shape, it's going to be for naught, because you're going to get all these diseases that come with age, and your last couple of years are going to be miserable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wish they would be more conscious of that.
Yeah, especially with all the drugs they're doing too.
Yeah, all the drugs, I mean, geez.
Yeah.
No, to each his own. What can I say? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the Olympia contest. So Frank Zane was in second place. So Frank, of course, was a three-time Mr. Olympia winner. And then he lost the title to Arnold in 1980 when he got third place, and he was injured that year. And then he took off 1981. And he came back in 1982, and he thought this would be an easy win for him, I think, you know, because then this was the year that Frank actually came in bigger. I remember this was the first time he was 200 pounds on stage.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've got the videotape from Wayne Galash from this 82 Olympia. And you know how they had the different rounds, standing relaxed?
Yeah.
So they had the comparison round, so standing relaxed. Frank looked really good. Like, way bigger than before. Like, he was standing right next to Joseph Wilkosch and another big guy. I think it was Bertel Fox. And Frank held his own. He didn't look small.
Wow.
Because
of
the extra size. But when they got to the second round, the mandatory poses, and he was posing, I noticed he was much smoother. Like, he just didn't have the same physique, because the definition wasn't he wasn't smooth. Don't get me wrong. He wasn't fat. But it just didn't. He didn't have that sharp, sharp definition that he had when he won it.
And that was his basic forte, his sharpness.
Yeah, yeah.
His definition. So that, you know. So I guess Chris was definitely a deserving winner. You know, when you look at it from that point.
Yeah, and Frank admitted that later on after the show was over. He said, "Yeah, I shouldn't have went that heavy, and I was too heavy. And I couldn't have won. But looking like that,
you think if Frank came in ripped and shredded like he was before, he would have beaten Chris?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think so too. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Casey Viator was in third, and this was Casey's best shape ever for the Olympia, for sure.
Yeah. Some people have said that Casey should have won that year.
I've heard Casey or Samir should have won.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Casey was in really great shape.
Yeah.
This, you know, very thick physique, you know, yet huge forms also.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Casey,
yeah, so Casey's an interesting story because, of course, he won the Mr. America at 19 years old, and he set the record for that. Great teenage bodybuilder, incredible condition for that age.
True.
And then he dropped out, and he didn't come back until the late 70s when he went to the NAVA Universe in 78, so that was like 7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been interesting to see what Casey would have looked like if he would have kept going, you know, if he never would have stopped.
I know. But like I said, I think I told you in a previous show how Casey tried to make a comeback a couple of years later in the Masters Olympia.
Yeah, he looked terrible.
Oh, God. It was just embarrassing. You know, I mean, I went backstage and I was talking to him. You know, I knew him pretty well. And I didn't want to say you look bad, Casey, but he said it. He goes like this. He says, you know, I know I look like shit. He goes, he says like this. he says, but you know, I only trained, like, I trained something like 2 months for this contest. He says, I just got divorced again, you know, again.
Yeah.
So he said, I didn't train for a long time. I tried to do a last minute thing and it just didn't work, you know. And he was laughing, same old Casey, you know, he wasn't pissed off or, laughing like, you know, like you didn't even care.
Yeah,
but I felt bad for him because it just didn't look like the Casey that I knew.
Yeah, I think this was. Do you think he looked better at this Olympia than he did when he was younger?
I think he was a little harder at this Olympia.
Yeah,
bigger too, a little bit bigger.
Yeah,
yeah. I think he did look better.
Yeah, know? Yeah. He was kind of smooth when he won the America, right?
Was a little smooth. I was just going to say he didn't have hardness. He had very round, thick muscles. But he didn't have the hardness. At the Olympia, he had a much more mature physique. You know, he had much more leg depth. His skin was thinner. His abs were out more.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in better shape at the Olympia. Yeah.
He looked really good in 1980, too. I think 1980 was the first year he went over to the IFBB. And he was doing a lot of Grand Prix shows. They had all the Grand Prix shows in the spring.
Right.
And it was him and Chris were battling back and forth. I remember Chris would win one and Casey would win one. He looked really, really good in those shows. But then by the time he got to the Olympia in October, he was burned out and he was real smooth.
So he never did. He didn't go in the 80 Olympia, did he?
Yeah, he got like 15th or 16th.
Oh, I didn't even realize he was in the 80 Olympia.
Yeah, he was way down. He was burned out. You could tell he was. But it was what was funny was Chris was competing with him, and Chris looked better than ever by the time he got to the Olympia.
Yeah.
A lot of people said Chris should have won that contest.
A lot of people said that.
Yeah.
Because Chris was peaked and Arnold wasn't.
Right. Right.
As great as Arnold is, he wasn't at his peak. The figures usually are like 75% of his best.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you shouldn't really win the contest if you're at 75%.
And when I interviewed Chris, he said that he thought he was at his best at that 1980 Olympia, better than when he won in 1982.
Yeah. I don't think anybody would have been mad if Chris Dickerson won.
No.
Except the Arnold fans, you know.
Arnold would have been mad.
And Arnold himself would have been very annoyed. That didn't happen.
And then Samir was the big surprise at this 82 Olympia because now Samir had been a pro since he won the 1979 Mr. Universe. So he'd been a pro since 1980 and he was always smooth, always, you know, never came into condition. This was the first time since he turned pro that he was shredded. He was ripped.
Right. 82. And he won the next year.
Yeah, he won the next year. Yeah. But I think he was a surprise by the judges. I don't think they expected him to be that ripped, and he only placed fourth. But I've heard a lot of people say that – in fact, Peter McGuff used to say that Samir should have won that show that year.
The 82 one?
Yeah.
Wow. Because I know he won the 83 easily.
Yeah.
He was perfectly peaked.
I think in 82, I think he was only like 186 pounds or something. He was really light. Yeah.
But, you know, the funny thing is after he won in 83, Samir never got back in that
same never did.
You know, and
he tried to come in too heavy.
Yeah, we talked about it. And, you know, what he told me was he would say stuff like, well, I was in fantastic shape the last week, but then I start stressing out for the last 2 days.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting this water retention. He blamed it on aldosterone.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
It's an adrenal steroid that, you know, when you're under stress, it's secreted. It causes your body to retain sodium and water. It's true. It really does.
Right.
So he said he was so stressed out that he would start to get this sheen of water, and that's why he wasn't doing well. So I said, well, what can you do about that, Samir? You got to find a way to control the stress.
Relax.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess he never did. I don't know what the, you know.
Yeah.
But he sure as hell was in great shape. In the 80s.
Samir always said that was his problem before he got ripped, too.
Yeah, I know.
The years when he was off before, too.
See, my question to him would be, well, what did you do in 82 and 83 to prevent that from happening?
Right, right.
Whatever you did, you should go back to it.
Right.
You know, that's what I would do. You know?
I think what happened, my personal opinion is after 83, I think he tried to get bigger.
Yeah.
And then he lost his waist. You know, remember he had a tiny waist, remember?
That's right.
Yeah.
You got a thick waist there. But the thing about you know, about some of those guys is they get that size fetish, and their structures can't really hold that much muscle.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like thick in the waist and stuff, and they don't have the hardness. Even this year's Mr. Olympia. I mean, just to get off the topic for a second, I give credit to those guys. A lot of them were in great shape. Don't get me wrong, but I couldn't help noticing when I look at the lineup, most of the guys when they stood, they had this kind of square, boxy look.
Yeah.
Even Hadi Chopin had that. When he flexed, he looked a lot different. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
There, he had this square, boxy look. And then that other guy, what's his name? The kid, I always forget his name.
Nick Walker or Derek Armstrong.
Nick Walker had it. Derek had a little bit less of the boxy look.
He had a small waist.
Yeah, that's because he kept standing with his arms out like that. He has those very wide legs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you didn't notice it on him, you know? But, you know, and I analyzed it. Why do these guys look so boxy when they're relaxed? And I said, you know why? Because they have more muscle on their body than their structure can really hold.
Yeah.
So when they stand and relax, it just sticks out and makes them look square and boxy. You know, of course, when they pose, they look much better. But I think that explains it. This guy, Hadi Chopin, is holding much more muscle than his structure can really stand. And
he was bigger this year than ever before, too.
Yeah, bigger, too, which made him look even more boxy. Still. Yeah. Luckily, he had the...
I remember Lee Labrati used to say that all the time. He's like, your structure can only hold so much muscle, and after you put on too much muscle, you lose the aesthetic appeal.
I totally believe that, especially the shorter guys. You know, these guys got to realize that once you reach a certain point, after that, it's going to start reverting where you don't look as good. You start to look real boxy and stuff like that.
But, yeah.
I mean, again, you know, when the guys turn to the back, I don't know if you noticed this, but a lot of the guys were missing a lot of Big Ramey, the lower part of his back.
Yeah, I saw that. That seems to be happening a lot now.
Yeah, it looked like it was erased.
Yeah, yeah.
It was nothing there. He had upper back, no lower back.
So what do you think caused that, Jerry?
I have no, I don't know, but Barry DeMay pointed it out too. Barry DeMay, you remember Barry DeMay from the...
I saw he saw his post.
Yeah, he put a post of himself competing in the Olympia where he had a tremendously defined lower back with a, you know, Christmas tree as Samir likes, all the lines coming out. And then he put a picture of Big Ramey next to him where there was nothing there at all.
Right.
And he says, what's with these guys? They can't get in shape or something like that. I really don't understand it. And even Hadi Chopin, when he turned to the back, he was lacking lower back, you know? I mean, most of those guys didn't have the kind
of... A lot of their lats are coming up. It looks like they're coming up. They're retracting.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether that has anything to do with what I was just saying about trying to put too much size on a structure. Now, Ramey's a big guy, but even he's maximized. The guy's 300 pounds.
Yeah.
If he got it in his head... where he says, well, I'm going to get even bigger and compete at 350 or 340, forget it. He wouldn't place in the top 10.
Yeah.
Because he's already maximized. I mean, he's already passed his maximum structure.
Also what's happening now, it's not just how big they're getting, but it seems like they're injecting different body parts with syringes, you know.
Yeah, and site infections.
Yeah, and they're getting nerve damage.
Yeah. Well, that could.
I think that might explain why their back is going up.
That could well, that very well could explain it because it was several guys like that.
Yeah.
Not just Big Ramey, but even Hadi, the winner, had a little bit lack compared to the way he was before. I think maybe they're putting the site injections. I don't know where they're doing it, but maybe it's somehow causing the obscuring their lower back muscle definition. I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah.
But I couldn't help noticing it. But a guy like Big Ramey, to me, he could, his body, even with his gigantic bone structure, he could support maybe a maximum of 275. Mm. Any more than that, he's going past his natural bone structure, and he's going to start to look bad. That's what I think.
Yeah.
It varies with each individual. Like I say, the shorter guys can't hold as much weight without getting that boxy look.
You know who else said that? You're not going to believe who said that, too. But I've got an old Muscle Builder magazine where even Arnold said that.
Arnold's
a big, tall guy, and he said, my best weight is 235. And he goes, I could compete heavier than that. But he goes, if I did, I would lose the lines to my physique.
He's right, because I've seen, you know, if you look at photos of him, there's photos of him where he weighed 250.
Yeah, and he's blocked.
And he was, and even when he lost to Zane, if you think back,
he was 250
in the 68 Universe in Florida.
Yeah.
He was 250. Remember how boxy he was, square?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't have it. He was way too
heavy. Doesn't have the smallest waist anyways.
No, he doesn't. He has a kind of a thicker waist. So
yeah,
he realized that himself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I would think that these guys, you know, they all have coaches or whatever. I would think that their coaches would have noticed this and kind of like tried to correct that. I have no explanation of why they didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I was surprised when I read that quote by Arnold because, I mean, this was back, I think he said it in 1975.
Yeah.
So this was before, you know, but you would think the guys always would try to get as big as possible, but you could tell the reasoning or the thinking was much different back then, where they were looking at it as an artistic thing. You know, you have to it's not just about the biggest, the hardest. It's about also developing a great-looking physique.
Yeah, and Arnold, he was right. 235 was his best weight.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when he competed in Sydney, I forget whether he weighed either 225 or 227. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, it might even been a little lighter than that, I think. 225.
Yeah. I mean, that's light for Arnold.
Yeah.
And it showed. It showed in his physique. You could see.
Yeah.
I mean, if he had competed at his former 235 body weight, it might have been, I mean, he might have looked a lot different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But he had to. I think he competed. Because, you know, he was doing the movies, and they didn't want him to get too big. So, he tried to stay lean. And I think that's one of the reasons to explain why he looked like that.
I think he just didn't have enough time to get the size back because he was real. Remember how skinny he was in the late 70s?
Yeah.
He went from that to Mr. Olympia in like 2 or 3 months. He just didn't have enough time.
That's true. Yeah. Right.
Well, fifth place at the 1982 Olympia was Albert Beckles.
Yeah.
And Albert had a great year that year. He was kind of Albert has another one with an interesting career because if you go way back to the 60s, he was competing in the NAVA universe. And then he actually won the IFBB universe in 1971.
Wow.
And then he was competing in Mr. Olympia in the late 70s, but he wasn't doing that well. He was kind of smooth. He wasn't as good as he used to be. And then he had this resurgence, like in the early 80s, he was killing it. Like he was winning all these pro shows. He was winning all these Grand Prix shows. Yep. So like I'm looking in 1982, he was in all these Grand Prix shows. He won the Grand Prix in New England.
Yeah.
And he took second in a lot of the contests. But in 1982, he won the Night of the Champions, which we're going to talk about in a minute. Yeah. And then he went to the Olympia, and he also won the World Pro Championship. So he won the other two big pro shows of the year, and then he went to the Olympia, and he got fifth place.
Right.
So he had a great year.
Well, yeah, I guess he must have changed his diet or something, you know?
Yeah, that's what it was. He was much harder. He was real ripped, you know?
Yeah, he definitely was a dominant figure in bodybuilding at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Great bicep he had and all that.
Yeah. And he went on, like 3 years after this, he was second place in the Olympia. So he had a really good run.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Top guy.
But it's amazing when you look at some of those guys from that era, like Chris Dickerson, Albert Beckles, Boyer Coe. Those guys competed for 30 years competitively. You know, isn't that amazing? The 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. It's unbelievable.
And I strongly doubt that the guys today are going to equal
that. No, they could never do that. No way. They're lucky if they last 10 years.
We both know why. It's the drugs. I mean, you know, I mean, the guys back then, sure, they used drugs, but nothing like these guys today.
Yeah, nothing.
It gave them longevity in bodybuilding. These guys today.
Yeah, who else could go for 30 years?
Yeah, no, none of these guys would get 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I personally, I don't even think Hadi Chopin's going to have his hands full to win the Olympia again next year.
I do too. I think so too. Yeah,
he's going to really have a fight to win it again because it was just too close with this guy Derek and
Nick Walker.
Yeah, Nick Walker and these other guys. They were just it was way too close.
Yeah.
You know, he'd have to come in considerably better next year.
And he's kind of a smaller guy too. He's not a big guy.
And and remember, keep in mind, as I said earlier, he's maximized for his structure.
Yeah. Yeah. He can't get any bigger.
I don't think he can get any bigger. I really don't.
He's just got to come in harder.
All he could do is come in noticeably harder.
Yeah.
Then he could win. But if he stays the same and those guys improve a little, he can move. He might drop down to maybe third place.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not enough to make the top three.
Yeah.
But he won't win if those guys are coming better than him.
I agree.
Yeah.
Sixth place in this show was Tom Platz.
Oh, Tom, yeah.
So Tom was third the year before in 1981. A lot of people thought he should have won in 1981.
Oh, true.
And then he became super popular. And I remember he was guest posing a lot. And then what happened with Tom was about 6 weeks before this contest, he tore his bicep.
I remember that too.
And he never got it fixed. He never fixed it. He didn't fix it until after the contest.
That was his kind of, that was the downward trend for Tom.
Yeah. Yeah.
After that, he never really reached the same heights, you might say.
And I don't think he was quite as good in this show as he was in 81. He wasn't as hard, I don't think.
Yeah. But he had those freaky legs.
Yeah.
That was so freaky that he continued to do, you know, exhibitions and seminars.
Oh, yeah. He was busier than anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he still does them, from what I understand. Not as much.
Yeah, he does squat seminars now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's still doing it. That's how freaky his legs were, that he still has, you know, people want to see and hear him, you know?
Yeah. Well, he's, I think to this day, he's one of the most popular bodybuilders ever, you know?
Yeah. You know, he's a personable guy, you know? Comes off as a nice guy, and you know, he says a lot of nice things. I could see where people like Platz,
but I think people relate to him because they know he's a hard worker. Because I think the legs are the hardest thing to build, and when someone's got legs like that, I think people just go, "Wow, this guy's a hard worker. He's a blue collar bodybuilder." You know,
he really is. No, I've watched him train, and he trains till blood comes out of his eyes.
Right, exactly.
I saw him and Tony Pearson do a leg workout once. When they finished, they literally leaned against the wall, they slid down. And they sat down. They couldn't even stand up.
Yeah.
Now, that is hard training.
Right, right.
That is hard training, let me tell you.
And he was so like, I'm going to win. I'm going to win the Olympia even if it kills me. Remember that quote?
Yeah. He was very dedicated.
Yeah, yeah. I think the fans love that. You know, that's why they love him so much. Not just his physique. I think it's his attitude.
It's kind of like the Rocky movies. You know, why do people like the Rocky? It's an underdog.
Yeah.
You know, people could root for him. People want people want someone they could root for.
Yeah. They love people that are that desire, you know, they have that desire and that hunger, you know.
Exactly, right.
Seventh place in the show, Jerry, was Muhammad Makawe. And this was interesting because now Muhammad had turned pro. He won the Mr. Universe in 1976. So that was 6 years before this.
Yeah.
But I saw him when I used to go to the Mr. Olympia shows in the late 70s. He used to compete, and he was never a factor. He was always a little bit too smooth. He always had those great abs, but he wasn't in rock-hard shape. And then this, I think, was the one show where he really came in great shape. And he was another one, like I think kind of like Samir, he was a big surprise of the judges. I don't think people expected him to look this good.
Well, you know what happened with Makawe? Makawe came out to California and started working with Vince Guaranda.
Right, right.
And Vince put him on the, you know, the meat and egg diet that I used. That, and, you know, taught him a couple of things. And he got that ripped, hard look. You know, Vince basically turned it around for him.
And he helped him with his posing, too. Right?
Helped him with posing, too. Yeah, he sure did.
Yeah.
So, you know, Makawe, I know he credits Vince. Because they showed up when they did a memorial after Vince died in the late 90s. Mm. Balik held a memorial for him at a hotel in Venice. And I sat next to Makawe. You know,
really?
Yeah, we were talking, and we were talking about Vince and his experiences. But he's kind of like Dickerson in a way, very, you know, very high class, you know, soft spoken, nice guy. You know, he's a very classy guy. Doesn't come off as a big mouth, you know, loud.
Right.
No, just a really nice guy.
Makawe. And I always liked how he posed to that classical music too.
Oh man, what a poser! Jeez.
Oh, one of the best ever.
I mean, it was like I say, I could say this about him and Ed Corney and Lee Labrada, you know, and John Brown and Sir, and even Sean Ray. It was almost like watching a ballet.
Yeah.
The way these men pose, even somebody not interested in bodybuilding at all would still be spellbound watching the moves these guys made because they were so artistic. You know, it wasn't, to bodybuilders, that's fun to look at, but to somebody outside of bodybuilding, it's kind of boring.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the best stories I heard from Charles Gaines when I interviewed him was he told me when they were in New York the year that the book Pumping Iron came out.
Right.
And they hired this publicity agent, Bobby Zarum. And this guy was really, really good at promoting stuff. And he had these guys like kind of mixing in with the New York elite crowd, the artistic crowd. And there was a restaurant in New York called Elaine's. And all the actors and the writers would all go to this place. You know, it was like the in place.
Yeah.
So Charles Gaines was going there a lot. And Charles Gaines knew a lot of these people anyways. So anyways, Charles met Kurt Vonnegut, the author. And his wife was a photographer. So Charles one day said, "Hey, guys, there's a bodybuilding show in New York. You guys want to come with me?" So he got like, I don't know, six or eight of these high-class literary elite people to go with him to this bodybuilding contest. And he was sitting next to Kurt Vonnegut and his wife, and they were blown away by Ed Corney's posing.
See that? There.
Yeah.
Who's what I'm saying?
Knew nothing about the sport, nothing about bodybuilding. They're total outsiders. They're elite. You know, they're these intellectual people, artistic people. They come from this literary world, and they see Ed Corney, and they're like, wow, they could really appreciate it, you know?
Yeah, that just proves what I'm saying.
Proves exactly. It's a great story,
I mean, again, some of the guys today can take lessons from some of them. Maybe they should improve their posing. Arnold was talking about this recently.
Yeah, yeah.
He's saying that the guys today need to work on their posing. He's right.
I agree 100%.
You know, it's important.
I noticed a couple of them were improved, but it's not quite there yet.
Yeah. You know what I'm surprised? I'm surprised that none of these guys ever posed. Maybe they did, and I never saw it. You would think that a natural posing music would be Strike a Pose by Madonna. Wouldn't that be like natural for a bodybuilder? Strike a pose. And he would do a pose. You know what I mean?
Right.
Nobody ever used that.
No. Maybe some women bodybuilders did.
Yeah, yeah. I've never seen it used in a contest. Huh.
Did I ever tell you that story when Arnold was going around promoting his book, Education of a Bodybuilder, in 1977? He was going everywhere, and he came to Chicago.
Yeah.
And he did television news interviews, and he did radio. Remember when they used to have, like, radio stations with the DJs?
Yeah.
And sometimes they would bring a guest on for just, like, a couple minutes, you know?
I do remember that.
He was on WLS, which was a big radio station in Chicago. And the guy was talking to him for a few minutes and interview him. And Arnold was really good, of course, as he always is. So the guy goes, "All right, Arnold, well, thanks for joining us." He goes, "We're going to play a song." He goes, "I'm thinking, well, I'll play Muscles from Diana Ross." And Arnold said, Arnold goes, "A better song would be You Are So Beautiful from Joe Cocker."
That's funny.
Great. Arnold was the best. Yeah. So continuing with this 82 Olympia, Bertil Fox was eighth. This was Bertil Fox's first Olympia.
Yeah. Now talk about a guy who needed help with posing.
Yeah.
Bertil Fox. Tremendous mass physique. Jeez, was he big.
Yeah.
I mean, but Arnold, I don't know if I told Arnold tried to work with him for like 2 hours once.
Oh, really?
Was when Bertil did that, he had these huge arms, but when he did a double arm, he would go like this.
Yeah.
Bring his forearms in too much and to make his arms look half the size they would.
Yeah.
And Arnold was telling him to keep your arms out. He showed him how to show his back. It just went in one ear and out the other. Bertil Fox never did it, never learned how. But I saw one interesting thing with Bertil Fox. I think I told you the story. I came into Gold's Gym. They were getting ready to photograph Bertil Fox for the Weta magazines. And he was in posing trunks and this and that. Looked tremendous, you know, tremendous. And I saw him pick up a pair of dumbbells, and you know, and he was, you know, doing alternate curls, and I looked at him, and they looked like at least 95 pounds each. And he was doing it like this, you know, like yeah. It looked like another guy would do 30-pound dumbbells. So I leaned over to the I don't remember who the photographer says. I said to him, I see you brought the fake weights. Those are the balsa wood weights, aren't you? Because they used to use these fake painted dumbbells.
Yeah.
This is a weight like less than half a pound, even though they look huge, right?
Yeah.
And the photos to make the guys look stronger, right?
Yeah.
Just another deceptive technique of the magazine. But anyway,
yeah, yeah.
So the guy says to me, Jerry, he says, those are real weights. What? He says, he took them off the rack. Those are 90-pound dumbbells. I said, you got to be kidding. You got to be kidding. I've never seen anybody curl weights that much like he's doing. He wasn't even struggling. He was going like this.
Yeah.
You know? I said, I can't even move a 90-pound dumbbell. This guy's doing curls with them.
Right.
I never forgot that, the power this guy had. Jeez. Yeah. Boy, was he strong.
But he's kind of like Eduardo Coac, who won the NABBA Universe several times, and then he comes over and he places kind of low in the IFBB.
Yeah, yeah. That's another guy like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny Fuller was ninth. Josip Wilkosz was 10th. Boyer Coe was all the way down in 11th.
Wow, he must have been off for that year, huh?
You remember how he looked that year? He was really thin.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he had a beard.
Right. That's right. That's right. I do remember that.
Now, I interviewed Boyer, and he goes, you know what happened that year was he said a lot of people thought I was natural. They thought I just was I went off the drugs because he was real skinny. He was real thin.
Yeah.
Didn't look like the Boyer Co that normally competed. He goes, you know what happened? He goes, him and his training partner were taking this supplement. They didn't realize it at the time. It was speed.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
And he said they were like jacked up. Like they couldn't stop talking. And then they were training like crazy. And he goes, I didn't feel like eating. And he goes, I lost all my muscle.
Wow.
And then he talked to his partner afterwards. And he told his partner, he goes, man, he goes, I've been like so depressed since the contest. Like, and he goes, his partner goes, me too. He goes, I'm crying all the time. So they found out when they got off the speed, they were having these withdrawals and that just their bodies were all screwed up.
And this was supposed to be a supplement?
I don't know if they didn't know they were taking – they didn't know it was speed, but I don't know if it was a supplement or just some pill they were taking or what it was. I think maybe they thought it was a drug that would help them with – but they didn't know it was speed.
Sounds like they were on methamphetamine for sure.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
All the symptoms you just meant, that's all methamphetamine, you know?
I don't even think he was natural. I think it just – it ate up all the muscle tissue.
No, you take enough of that stuff, it does eat up muscle tissue.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're in it stimulates a lot of cortisol. You get catabolic.
Yeah.
You know, and I could see that happening.
Danny Padilla was 12th.
Danny, wow.
And he got fifth the year before. A lot of people thought he should have won the year before.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. I don't know. People argue with me, but I swear to you, I know I've said this to you before.
Yeah.
I think in 81, Danny was a clear winner. I mean, that was a perfect fit. That was just like I was describing Chris earlier. Had everything. Everything, delts, arm. He, and unlike Chris, he did have great arms.
Oh yeah,
big calves, great legs, leg bicep.
He is back, full, upper back, full and big everywhere.
He had everything. The only thing he lacked was he was short. He was 5'4", whatever. Yeah. That's it. So what? The guy who won was Colombo. What was he? 5'5"?
Yeah, right.
It didn't make any sense.
No.
So I don't understand that. I mean, what did Danny not trained for this show?
Yeah, he looked smaller and he was smooth. So it looked like he lost his drive after 81, you know.
He probably did. But, you know, Danny, you know, he's always had a carefree attitude towards training.
Yeah,
you know, he used to go back to Rochester, New York, work with his father in this grocery store, whatever they had, and he wouldn't train.
Yeah.
He'd get a little pot belly and stuff. Then he decided he wanted to train for a contest, and he trained for a couple of months, and he goes back and forth. Maybe he just didn't prepare, you know, long enough for this contest.
He told me his motivation in 81 was he wanted to compete against Franco because Franco was his idol.
Oh, okay.
When he was growing up, you know, because Franco's a short guy.
Yeah.
And, he knew that was going to be Franco's last time, so he wanted to compete against him. You know, he wanted to be at his best.
Yeah. Did he want to beat him or just want to compete against him?
It's not like he just wanted to compete against him, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Jacques Nouville was 13th.
Yeah, from France.
He won the Mr. Universe the year before.
Right.
Tinarino was all the way down in 14th, which I think he was placed unfairly because I think he was in good shape that year.
I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I don't either.
Huh.
Because I remember seeing pictures from him. He had the mustache too.
Yeah.
But I remember he was big. He was big and cut. So
this is the 82 Olympia you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember seeing him around that time. He was in great shape.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't explain that. Why the hell did he get so low?
I don't know. I'd like to see the judges' score sheets. I'll have to see if I can find them.
It doesn't make any because he had the great abs, you know?
He was super wide. You know, he always had
very, very wide, very wide. I have no explanation for that. I can't figure that one out.
Lance Dreher was 15th, almost last. And that was his first Mr. Olympia. He won the Mr. Universe the year before, 1981. Yeah. He beat Gunnar Rospo in 1981 at the Olympia. This was Lance's first pro show. I think he kind of did it wrong. I mean, if I was him, I think what I would have – now, he told me – I interviewed Lance, too. Yeah. And Lance said that after he won that Mr. Universe, he's kind of an unknown. He was really well-known in Chicago. Everybody in Chicago loved him. They thought he was going to be Mr. Olympia. They thought he was like Arnold, you know, with the big arms, you know.
Huge arms.
But outside of Chicago, I don't think too many people knew Lance. So when he came in and he won that Mr. America heavyweight class and then he won the Mr. Universe, he really wasn't well-known. But I think Weider offered him a contract to come to California, but he wasn't going to pay him much, you know. Okay. And Lance had a full-time job. I think he was married, and he's like, I'm not – and he had a house. He goes, I'm not uprooting everything to move to California if you're not going to pay me, you know.
Can't blame him. Yeah.
No, I can't blame him either. But as a result, he didn't get any publicity. So he goes into the Mr. Olympia. Nobody really knew who he was, and I don't think he was in his best shape either. So I think what he should have did was at least – he should have came to California. He should have did photo shoots, maybe did a smaller pro show first and sort of got his name out and then do the Olympia. But to do the Olympia as your first pro show, I think that was a mistake.
I think everything you just said makes perfect sense. I totally agree. He was like the overlooked.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Because the guy wasn't a bad body, but he had some, you know, really.
He had really good back. He had huge arms, you know.
Yeah. I just think it was lack of publicity and.
Place that low, though. That was.
Yeah, that's probably what happened.
And then last place, 16th place, was Roger Walker, who I remember was really out of shape that year. He was smooth.
Oh, man, he must have been. He was a top guy in 80.
Yeah, and yeah, he was. Right, he was there. Sixth place, yeah.
I mean, you know, the photos of him in the lineup, when he stood next to Arnold, he actually looked in a little bit better than Arnold standing relaxed.
Yeah, he did. He was standing right next to him.
So he must have really really let himself go a little bit there.
Yeah, he was smooth. He was really, like, out of shape.
Yeah, if you look at his physique, John, he has the type of physique where he has to be in absolute top shape or forget it.
Yeah, because he is kind of blocky, right?
Yeah, exactly. A guy like Frank Zane can get away with being a little bit smooth, you know?
Yeah.
But Roger Walker, he had to be absolute in peak shape. Otherwise, no, it's either in shape or gone. That's it. There was no in between for a guy like that.
What did you think about Chris Dickerson's elbows at that show? Do you think that kind of gave him a bad look?
A little bit, but you know, a lot of people said it was from using growth hormone.
Yeah.
You know, I don't.
They were really big.
Yeah, I mean, growth hormone can cause the growth of certain bones past maturity. You know what I mean? And that can't make you taller once your bones are fused. There's a possibility that was caused by growth hormone. But it also could have been caused by injuries. You know, maybe he had some sort of injury that caused, you know, some sort of extra bone growth effect.
I don't remember his elbows looking like that in 1980 or even 81.
No, I didn't either.
Especially 80, I don't remember. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to say. It could be either from some sort of injury or from using growth hormone, one of the two.
Because 1982, I don't think they didn't have synthetic growth hormone yet, right? Were they still using the cadavers?
No, they were using the cadaver stuff then. It's dangerous.
Which is really dangerous. Yeah.
I don't know if Chris knew about that. It was very dangerous. They were taking it from, some of these cadaver-based growth hormones, they contain organisms called prions, which, and if you took a growth hormone from a cadaver that was, let's say, contaminated by these prions, when they get in the brain, they literally eat your brain. You know, they poke holes in your brain. It's a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
Yeah,
horrible death. Wow. So, you know, the recombinant growth hormone, the one they still use today, that came out in 85. So based on that, I'm kind of like putting it together in my head as I speak. I don't think Chris was on growth hormone because, you know, it was much harder to get. That's another thing. So you have to understand the cadaver based growth hormone was much harder to get than the later forms of growth hormone.
Oh yeah, it would have to be, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, unless he had some sort of connection where he can get that type of growth hormone. I think it was called Crescormin, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Unless he had some sort of direct connection, I don't see how he could have gotten it. So, you know, I when I add it all up, I don't think it was growth hormone that caused the elbow stuff. Yeah. It must have been some sort of injury where, you know, sometimes you keep injuring it, your body will lay down extra calcium.
Yeah.
And it'll actually start to make it stick out like that.
Yeah.
I think it could have been some sort of repetitive stress injury that caused that.
Well, my elbows are a little bigger than they used to be, just from all the inflammation, I think, in the elbows, yeah.
You know, when you a lot of tricep work after the year, you know, you're putting a lot of stress on the elbows, and, you know, you might get a little bit of extra calcium laid down, so they get thicker. It's not pathological, as long as you don't have any pain.
Yeah.
Just maybe not look good, but it's not going to enter. I mean, he could still flex his arms and do tricep.
Yeah, yeah.
Aesthetically, you could say it doesn't look that great. You know?
Yeah.
So
looking at that 82 Olympia, Jerry, how do you think, how would you have placed it if you would have been a judge? Would you have Chris as the winner still?
Which one?
The 82 Olympia.
Oh, yeah. I would have had Chris.
Yeah.
I would have had Chris because he came in, like he said himself, he probably was a little bit better at the 80 show.
Yeah.
When I look at the photos, he was in really hard shape at the 80, but he still got it together. He had, like I said, all those attributes I mentioned earlier, the symmetry, the proportions, the posing.
Yeah.
He had what they called the complete package.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think it was his time to win. It was his time to win. So I definitely would have given it to him.
It's interesting, too. He went back and had Bill as his coach. He actually went to Oregon, and he stayed out there for a couple months. And
he trained with him. Bill's barn. He had a barn.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah. Yeah. It worked for him. You know?
Yeah. Great ending to a great career. Right.
I remember the very first issue of Flex Magazine, which was 1982.
Yeah. He was the cover.
It was Chris holding. It wasn't the Sandow.
It was just a trophy. Yeah.
Trophy. And he was holding his arm up. Remember that?
Oscar State promoted that show.
Yeah. That was my first Weider article in that issue.
Oh, really? Okay. I got that issue.
Yeah. If you're looking, I had something about whether a bodybuilder should bulk up or not. I can't remember exactly.
I'll have to look at it.
Yeah. It was a two-part issue. It was in the first issue of Flex and the second issue.
Okay. I still got that. I've got all those old ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the World Pro Championships, which was an IFBB pro show that was held in February, I believe. And I think it was held in Atlantic City, if I'm not mistaken. And Albert Beckles beat out Boyer Coe for the title.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of Albert's first pro wins. He'd won some in 81 as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was kind of an upset because Boyer was usually the guy to win these contests. So Albert beat Boyer at that show.
Right.
Johnny Fuller was third. So we mentioned Johnny Fuller. And McCauley actually did good in this show, too. He got fourth. So I think he wasn't as good as he was at the Olympia, but he was getting there. So he must have been working with Vince already at this time.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Roy Callender was fifth. And I remember seeing the pictures. Roy was still thick. So this was right after, only a couple months after that 81 Olympia,
where
Roy looked fantastic.
Yeah, yes, he did.
And then Tony Pearson was sixth.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray Mentzer, who you just mentioned, he was seventh.
Right.
So that was a good win for Albert. And I think it was pretty close between him and Boyer, from what I remember.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
So that was in February. And then they didn't have the Arnold Classic back then. That wasn't around yet. I think Arnold and Lorimer, I don't think they promoted any shows in 82.
Right.
Because they promoted the 81 Olympia, and I think they got a lot of criticism for that, of course. So I don't think they promoted any IFBB shows for 5 years.
Wow.
I think their next one was 1986.
There's a lot of fallout from that show.
Yeah, for sure. So the Night of the Champions was held in May. Now this was the Night of the Champions started in 1978. Robbie Robinson won the first two in 78 and 79. And then 1980 and 81 was won by Chris Dickerson.
Right.
And then Chris didn't compete in any other shows except the Olympia in 82. He saved it all for the Olympia.
Right.
But Albert Beckles won the 1982 Night of the Champions. And he beat out Bertel Fox. So this was Bertel Fox's IFBB debut. So this was the – everybody had been anxiously waiting to see Bertel Fox compete because we all saw him win the NABBA Universe. And then I remember Joe Weider had him over for some photo shoots. You remember that famous photo shoot where he's doing the dips?
Yes.
His chest was just hanging like this. Yeah. And his arms look like they're 30 inches.
Right. I do.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that was like a bulked up Bertel Fox. So –
yeah,
but Bertel ended up taking second place. And when I interviewed Rick Lane, he talked about this a little bit. And he said Bertel was never really comfortable competing. And Rick Lane said, one of my biggest regrets is that I talked Bertel to moving to the United States to work under Joe. Because he goes, he wasn't comfortable living in the United States. He didn't like it.
Yeah, I heard that too.
He liked living in London. And he liked, he said Bertel was just comfortable training in the gym. And he didn't really like being on stage, you know.
Yeah.
What I want to mention about this Night of the Champions, Jerry, was that Bertel Fox really came in light. You remember that? He was really underweight.
Right, yeah.
Everybody was expecting this monster, and he looked like he lost way too much size from the dieting.
He probably tried to get – figured the way to win would be to get as cut as possible.
Yeah.
So probably dropped too much weight, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Albert Beckles was able to beat him, and it's interesting. The top three guys were all black bodybuilders from England, Albert Beckles, Bertel Fox, and Johnny Fuller, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then, like I said, McAway got fourth. Padilla got fifth. So Padilla was also coming off that 81 Olympia. So he was probably in pretty good shape for this show. And then he lost it by the Olympia. Tony Pearson was sixth. Ron Tufel was seventh.
Wow.
Dave Johns was eighth. Greg DeFerro ninth. And Ray Menser 10th.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is Robbie is listed as like 12th.
Robbie Robinson?
Last place.
He was the original winner of the night.
The original winner the first 2 years, yeah.
Wow.
And I want to mention your Applied Metabolics newsletter here, which we always mention at the end of each show. So people are interested in subscribing to that. They can just go to appliedmetabolics.com.
Right.
And it's only $10 a month, and they'll get this massive newsletter every month.
Yeah, tremendous amount of information on nutrition, exercise, general medicine, health, a bunch of stuff about the old days with Arnold and all those guys in the golden era.
Oh,
a lot of good stuff in there. I think people really like it. And it's written in, you know, regular, normal English, no technical stuff like some of these other digital public. It's really good stuff, if I say so myself.
Yeah.
It's www.appliedmetabolics.com.
How many years have you been doing that now, Jerry?
I started in 2014. So I guess this is the ninth year?
Wow. No kidding. 2014. I didn't know you started it that long ago. That's amazing.
Yeah. Is that, you know, eighth year, isn't it? Did I get that?
Yeah, 8 years. Yeah, 8 years.
Eight years.
Going into the ninth. Yeah.
I started it not long after I stopped writing for the magazines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's probably about the time I stopped writing for Iron Man.
Yeah, I started. I'd stopped writing about a year before that, but it took me about a year to find a webmaster, what they call themselves, who could set it up for me the way I wanted the news.
Oh, okay.
You know, because I went through about 15 different people who said that they can do it. Turned out that they could. I finally found, you know, this brother and sister team that was it, and they're still running it, you know, on their web, whatever it is.
Okay.
So yeah, that's why it took so long. So I've been going ever since. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right.
I really enjoy doing it, you know, because I learn when I do the research. I always learn something. Like I'm doing an article right now on muscle damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have to damage your muscles in order for them to grow? Because, you know, the three accepted promoters of muscle growth are mechanical tension. You know, that's putting stress on the muscle, like lifting weight. The second one is is what they call my brain's not working. metabolic stress. You know, the byproducts when you really work out. And the third one is muscle damage. And you know, the big controversy is that there's been studies showing you don't have to damage your muscle. And when you think about it, if muscle damage was required to stimulate muscle growth, you'd have to damage your muscles every time you worked out.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. So there's other things involved. So I get into all the other things of why muscle damage can indirectly, you know, stimulate muscle growth rather than, you know, destroying your muscle every time you work out. So I think
that's interesting you said that, because I just saw an interview. Paul Revelia is the guy who owns Pro Physique, is that online coaching company I'm working for.
Yes.
And Paul's a really intelligent guy, and he interviewed somebody on his podcast. And this guy was a exercise research scientist, I believe, at the University of Florida here, University of South Florida, USF. Uh-huh. And this researcher was saying that it's more beneficial to work a body part two or even, if you can, three times per week than it is to work it once per week.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about changing my training. So he was basically saying, like, if you normally do like 12 sets for your chest, instead of doing 12 sets once a week, do 6 sets, but do it twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking of doing that with my routine, but I was looking at it and I was like, I don't know if my joints would recover in time to do it twice a week. And so
you're hitting a muscle once a week now, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, yeah.
So I train like Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday.
Right.
And I do everything once a week. I'll do chest and triceps, legs, shoulders, and back and biceps. Okay. And this guy was saying you'd be better off, even if you're only training 4 days a week, but split your body up over 2 workouts instead of 4 workouts and train each muscle group twice a week.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've seen some studies where they've tried to figure out the optimal frequency for training a muscle, and they come up with twice a week is the best frequency, optimal frequency. But then they compare hitting a muscle twice a week to once a week, and they found as long as you do the same volume of exercise, the results are exactly the same. It doesn't make a difference. So I guess it depends on how you respond more than anything else, you know?
Yeah, because I was thinking if I did that, let's say I'm doing 12 sets for my chest and I only do 6 sets for it, I'm sure I'm not going to be sore.
Right, no.
I'm only doing half the workout.
Yeah, right.
But then you can do the workout twice and you can train the muscle twice instead of once.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking at my age and with all the training I've done, I'm wondering if my joints will be able to recuperate by the time I do that second workout.
No, that's something to consider, you know.
Yeah.
But maybe by splitting it up twice, remember, you're doing less volume.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So there's less exercise. There's less stress on the joints.
On the joints, yeah. So I might be able to do it.
It might equal out. The only way to do it is to try it.
Yeah,
see how you respond. And if you feel that it's not for you, go back to once a week.
Right, yeah. I think I might try it this year.
I mean, so many guys are now training each muscle once a week. It's like the most popular way to do it now, you know?
Yeah. Like, I just did legs yesterday, and my legs are sore, so I don't know. They might be sore for, like, 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
But I could probably still get away with, like you said, if you're doing half the volume, you could probably get away with doing.
As long as the volume is equal, in other words, like you said, instead of 12 sets, do 6 sets twice a week, the same volume.
Yeah.
What the study shows, you'll get the same amount of muscle gains.
Right.
It's up to you, whatever you prefer. Some guys just like to train a muscle a little bit more often. It's more psychological than anything else. You know,
I've tried before in the past, like training real heavy one day and then like 3 or 4 days later going lighter.
Yeah.
That's different. What this guy's saying is do your regular workout, do the same weights and everything, but just do half the volume and then do the other half, like you were saying.
Right.
You
know? Right. I remember one of the worst routines I tried was given to me by none other than Bill Pearl. He had me on a 6-day a week split where each muscle was hit 3 times a week.
Wow.
That's the way he trained. And it was like, it was like 15 sets, I think, per muscle, 3 times a week. And I was only, I was maybe 22 or 20. I was young and, you know, I couldn't handle it.
No.
I lasted about 2 weeks and I felt completely overtrained.
Oh,
15 sets of muscle, but 3 times a week, I never recovered.
No, you can never recover from that.
Remember, you know, I'm drug free.
Yeah.
Maybe if I took drugs, it would be different, but I was not taking anything.
Yeah, I heard Arnold used to do that too when he was getting ready for the Olympia. Three times a week, he would train every body part, 6 days a week, twice, double split routine.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's true because I used to see him. I never saw him train a muscle more than twice a week.
That was probably. You know,
what he did though is he did a double split.
Yeah.
He would do one muscle in the morning, then he'd come back in the late afternoon. But he still did it twice a week, though. It wasn't six, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't three, I should say. So it's possible. Maybe I didn't notice it. But I trained with him a couple of times. Sometimes I trained with him a week at a time, and I don't remember hitting a muscle more than twice a week with him. Except for calves he did more often.
Yeah.
Calves about four times a week.
Probably just the magazines.
Yeah, you know how that goes.
Yeah. All right, Jerry. Well, thank you very much again for all your time. I appreciate it. I enjoyed the conversations, and we'll meet up again soon, and we'll talk about 1992.
Sounds good, John. Take care. Nice talking to you, as always.
All right. You too, Jerry. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Branham for contributing all his time to talk about the year 1982. If you guys are new to the show, what we typically do at the end of every year is we go back 30 years, 40 years, and 50 years, and we review all the big events that happened in the year of bodybuilding. So since the year 2022 just ended, we went back 50 years, and we talked about the year 1972, and then Jerry and I just wrapped up 1982. And when we meet again on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, we will talk about the year 1992, which was 30 years ago. So hopefully that will be in a week or so, when I get a chance to interview Jerry again. I want to thank our Patreon sponsors for contributing to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. You guys, with your monthly donations, really help the show keep going. So thank you very much. If you guys are interested in becoming a Patreon donor yourself, as I said, just go to the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon donor. And if you guys are looking to hear any of our old podcasts, I have all of our podcasts that we've done for the 5.5 years of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. They are on the website. I know sometimes if you go to Spotify or if you go to Apple Podcasts, you don't get all of them. But if you want to check out all of the podcasts we've done, go to the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and just click the podcast link, and you will see all of the podcasts that we have done. So if you miss some from 5 years ago, we've done, I don't know, I think we're over 250 shows now. So just go on that website. I just updated it. I put all the latest ones on there. So they are all up there. So check that out when you get a chance. And also you can check out my YouTube page under my name, John Hansen. And I've got several of the interviews there. And when I do them on YouTube, they are videos, of course. And I add pictures and video clips, so they're really interesting to check out. And then, as I mentioned, we have the Transformation Challenge with Pro Physique. If you guys are interested in entering that, I have the link below in the description. And you can use me as a coach if you like, but $50,000 in prize money, so check it out. The entry deadline is January 23rd, so you got about 2 weeks to enter that. All right, before I let you guys go, I want to read two articles from the 1982 Mr. Olympia. One of them comes from Iron Man magazine. The other one is from the very first issue of Flex magazine. So this first one was written by Gary Bartlett, and it's from the March 1983 issue of Iron Man magazine. And it says, Dickerson is new Mr. Olympia by Gary Bartlett. After placing second for two consecutive years, Chris Dickerson has won the 82 Olympia. Chris's odyssey to this prestigious title was long and full of many triumphs and disappointments. This would be his last attempt, and under the expert guidance of Bill Pearl, the cards were stacked in his favor. Chris had devoted a full year to preparing for his final assault on the Olympia, and nothing would stand in his way. In winning, one cannot honestly say that Chris didn't deserve it. In fact, of anyone of the 16 bodybuilders competing, Chris was the most prepared. He was certainly aware of how to finish second. This he easily achieved in 80 and 81. This year, Chris was prepared to play for the number one spot. Many people may argue that Dickerson did not possess the best physique in the contest. In fact, if you were to study Chris's physique closely,
you would have no trouble in spotting a few flaws. I particularly noticed that one of his elbows appeared swollen and contained a prominent knob at the end. It looked as though the tricep muscle had been torn, causing it to shrink away. We must ask the question, how then was Dickerson declared Mr. Olympia in 1982? The answer to this question is not easy. I can only give my explanation as to why I think he won. To get a better answer, you would have to question the seven IFBB judges. As a package, Dickerson looked very good. He was sharp, symmetrical, and prepared 100%. His game was that of a professionalism and vast experience with the necessary elegance and charm to sway the judges' votes. One must remember that by placing second for the past 2 years, that he established himself as the man to beat. It would be very hard for an unestablished champ to knock him off. It certainly was expected that master of the podium, Frank Zane, was the only man that Dickerson could have trouble with. This year's IFBB Olympia will go down in bodybuilding history as one full of surprises and, more importantly, major disappointments. Surprises came in the way of the incredible conditions of Mohamed Makawe, Casey Viator, and Samir Banoot. My disappointments were in the less than top conditions of Frank Zane, Tom Platz, Boyer Coe, Bertel Fox, Danny Padilla, and Albert Beckles. Arriving in London after a long flight from Canada, I was ecstatic over the prospect of an 82 Olympia where Zane, Coe, Dickerson, Beckles, Platz, Padilla, and Fox would battle for the number one title in world bodybuilding. As the lineup for the 82 Olympia filed out in front of the packed Wembley Arena, my heart sank. In the past, one could expect each competitor to be at their all-time best condition. This year, it was not to be. Mistimed peaks and the delusion of super condition were to be common in our Olympia champs. Perhaps the constant admiration of the many fans and previous wins only served to blind our champs as to how they really looked. In fact, only the evening before, our Olympians cried that they were not getting enough prize money for their efforts. After witnessing a few of these champs' 82 condition, I would have to say that they were lucky to get the prize money offered. Perhaps if they were to compete in splendid condition worthy of the Olympia, more prize money could be offered. Many people went to a lot of trouble and expense to promote this event. More importantly, fans traveled long distances at great expense to see their bodybuilding heroes, and with the exception of a limited few, their heroes had let them down. The contest was very well organized and run with the efficiency that the British are known for. However, the sparkle of former Columbus shows was missing. IFBB top official Oscar State, in his effort to run a tightly regimented ship, frosted some of the glitter and glamour that we so fondly remember from past Olympia encounters. In spite of this, the event was outstanding, and the IFBB must be praised for its efficiency. The press was treated with the utmost regard, assuring us of excellent locations to obtain top-quality photographs. Following is a description of each contestant in the order he placed. 16th was Roger Walker from Australia with 240 points. This was by far the worst condition I've ever seen Roger compete in. It was a far cry from the splendid condition of 1980 where he placed 6th. Roger could have saved a lot of the organizers' money along with his pride if he had not made this trip. 15th, Lance Dreher from the USA, 207 points. This was my first look at Dreher. Lance has everything needed to be a champion: good looks, huge proportions, good symmetry, and stage presence. Unfortunately, Lance neglected the most important ingredient, super cut. 14th, Dennis Tenorino, USA, 192 points. Dennis is a past Olympian competitor who has become a favorite of many fans. Today, he was inferior in many of his past showings. Although massive, dramatic, and entertaining, Dennis still had not improved his structural weaknesses. He did put on a splendid posing exhibition, which really got the London audience involved. But to finish in the money, he needed more than a spunky routine. 13th, Jacques Nouville, France, 189 points. Competing in his first Olympia, Nouville was very symmetrical and defined. In fact, Nouville was impressive enough to place higher than veterans Tenorino and Walker. With more experience and additional size, Nouville could move up in the money in the coming year. 12th, Danny Padilla, USA, 186 points. One of the major disappointments of this year's Olympia was Danny Padilla. Far from his outstanding 81 condition, Danny was only a shadow of his former self. He appeared small and flat, which was in complete contrast to his full rib condition of last year. Obviously, he mistimed his peak, and it was very easy to guess that he was much smaller. Entering into this competition as one of the favorites, it was a major upset to see Danny drop to 12th place. 11th, Boyer Co., USA, 184 points. I had become very good friends with Co. in the past few years, and I must say that my heart really sank when I saw Boyer in the lineup. I fully expected Boyer to be in the best condition of his life. However, this was not to be. Boyer was smaller, and his famous rip muscle density was just not there. Much like Padilla, his muscles appeared flat and lacked that fullness which only an Olympian winner can have. After many years of splendid peaks and wins, one would think that a veteran such as Co would realize his lack of superior condition. This was not the Co of 81, where he literally blew everyone away in Atlantic City and Montreal. The thing that really depressed me was that Boyer performed a brilliant posing routine to the music from Rocky III, The Eye of the Tiger. This was one of the best routines I had ever witnessed. Had Co been in his best condition, he would have been declared Mr. Olympia 82. As it was, he brought the London audience to their feet with the most inspiring routine. 10th place, Josef Wilkosch, Germany, 132 points. Much heavier than last year, Wilkosch, in gaining the additional size, sacrificed necessary cuts. His upper body looked excellent and was one of the largest in the contest, but his lack of leg size and separation would cost him valuable points. I feel if Josef could pose with more showmanship, he would definitely finish higher. His expression is stony, and compared to the masterful Dickerson and Zane, he's still an amateur. Many of our pros still hate to admit that smiling and acting while posing has anything to do with their placing. If they believe this, then they are destined to finish out of the money. 9th, Johnny Fuller, England, 131 points. England's Johnny Fuller has tasted the wine of victory in his last few contests. With two recent third-place finishes, one could be safe in speculating that at this year's Olympia, Johnny would certainly be in the top six. Unfortunately, Johnny would have to settle for a mediocre 9th. The problem was not in Johnny's condition, as he was in his usual ripped and vascular shape. No, it seems that he recently injured his pectoral muscle, resulting in a tear, which was quite prominent during the prejudging. I felt that the judges deducted points for this obvious lack of symmetry, resulting in a lower placing. Such are the inhuman demands placed on the physiques required by the Olympia. We all hope that Johnny can improve the injured pec. 7th was a tie, Bertel Fox from England, 119 points. There would be no 8th place. Instead, we would have a tie for 7th between Bertel Fox and Mohamed Makawe. Fox was awesome. As he flexed, his massive physique literally swelled with muscle and striations. Bertel's gargantuan mass and bulk were what the Britishers came to see, and he didn't let them down. Each time Bertel hit his famous most muscular shots, the Wembley Conference Center came alive with shouts of, "Beef it, Bertel, beef it." It was quite obvious that Fox was their favorite. Unfortunately, what the London audience saw was not what our IFBB judges were looking for. Bertel, although impressive while flexed, lost out in the relaxed round. He was just not as sharp as the other top six men. 7th, Mohamed Makawe, Egypt, also 119 points. Sheer beauty and poetry in motion was Mohamed Makawe. In all honesty, Mohamed was my choice for the 82 Olympia. How he managed to finish in 7th place is totally against all bodybuilding logic. I personally feel it is outrageous that Makawe finished lower than 3rd. He was tight, sharp, well-proportioned, sharply defined, and more importantly, perfectly symmetrical. He has the best skin tone and overall healthy appearance of anyone in the entire competition. If you combine all this with an inspiring and professional posing exhibition, you have a worthy Olympia winner. Unfortunately, the judges saw Mohamed differently, and for the life of me, I don't know what they were looking for. Perhaps he has not established himself as a winner in previous contests. Mark my words, Mohamed will not be denied his proper placing, and 83 will be his year. 6th, Tom Platz, USA, 103 points. Much has been written regarding Tom Platz in the past year, proclaiming him the uncrowned Olympia. Based on his outstanding performance in 81, Tom would be the man to win in 82. In fact, he already was proclaimed Mr. Olympia in many people's minds. Sadly, in his effort to improve his already inhuman physique, he pushed it to the breaking point. Something had to give under this tremendous stress of pre-contest training. Only 1 month before the Olympia, his bicep muscle tore, resulting in a tragic injury. Not wanting to disappoint as many fans, Tom competed in spite of this painful injury. During the prejudging, it was quite easy to spot the injured bicep. Much smaller than the other, it could only hinder his placing. Regardless, Tom did his best, and he was still very close to his 81 condition. We all hope he's able to heal his injured arm and come back better than ever. Fifth place, Albert Beckles, England, 100 points. Competing in front of 3,000 hometown fans, Albert stood with the best of them. At 46 years of age and just being able to compete in the Olympia is a feat in itself, but to finish in the top five is incredible. Albert was impressive, but I saw him compete in New York last spring where he won with a physique that had taken Rip to a new level. Today, Albert was just off this condition. In spite of this, he still was a good fifth, and many of our younger boys had to move over and make room for this veteran of the posing platform. Fourth, Samir Banute, USA, 82 points. A complete and total surprise of the 82 Olympia was Samir Banute. Samir, after many attempts at competition, had established himself as somewhat of a joke. Never being able to get rid of the water, he was never taken very seriously. Today, however, Samir would have the last laugh. Perfectly proportioned and incredibly ripped, Samir was fully prepared to win the 82 Olympia. His perfect balance made it very hard to look at anyone else. I personally would have placed Samir in the top three. Again, much like Macaulay, Samir is still wet behind the ears, and he needs a few more shows under his belt. In spite of everything, he would have made a popular winner. His condition was certainly worthy of an elusive crown. Third, Casey Viator, USA, 61 points. Everyone knew Casey was capable of an outstanding showing. In fact, Casey was long overdue with the potential he has. Fortunately, he chose London to display his newfound cuts. Posing to the soundtrack from Conan, Casey looked awesome. Every inch of his physique was crammed with chiseled muscular mass. He definitely was in the running to pull a major upset. Would the lack of contest in the past 2 years hinder his chances of challenging such veterans as Zane and Dickerson? I personally felt that it didn't, and that he was, in fact, superior to Zane and Dickerson. Again, the judges saw it differently, as Casey would have to settle for third. As far as I'm concerned, Casey had plenty of everything necessary to wear the Olympia crown. Second, Frank Zane, USA, 56 points. I have been a Zane fan for many years, and I felt that he would easily win the 82 Olympia. Sadly, this was not to be. Less than his perfect 79 Olympia condition, Zane was a disappointment to me. I fully expect to see him win the show in the best condition of his life. Seeing him backstage before the competition, I sensed that my dream of again seeing a superior Zane was shattered. The ripped vascular Zane of 79 was missing, replaced by an inferior replica. Yes, the symmetry was evident, but the thickness and mass was missing. He was 2 years older, and for the first time in his career, his age was showing. A wrinkle here, a bit of loose skin there. In a competition as close as the Olympia, all these things add up. I also felt that Frank lacked his former winning attitude. He seemed apprehensive and anxious. Regardless, Frank still displayed many of his famous Zane strong points and classic poses. His battle was fought aggressively and with tenacity. His vast knowledge and cunning stage presence enabled him to place higher than many people felt he should have. Mr. Olympia 1982 was Chris Dickerson, USA, 29 points. Chris had journeyed to London to win the Olympia, and right from the start, it was clear what his game was. His final assault would end in supreme victory. I did not feel that Chris had the best physique in the contest, although he was in excellent condition. I felt that Macaulay, Viator, and Banute all were superior to Chris, and perhaps Chris had that. But perhaps Chris had that something extra. So how did he win? The answer is professionalism and attitude. He was in shape and was able to show in each round his best features while hiding his weaknesses. Chris, more than any other competitor, got the most from what he had to show. Had Viator, Macaulay, or Banute been able to do this, then we would be looking at a different winner. Like everything, bodybuilders must age and mature to be at their best. Chris played the game without a hitch, while the others made unprofessional mistakes. Like a sprinter, Dickerson edged the others out in the last few yards. All the years of competition finally paid off for Chris, giving him the edge and experience to win in his final quest for the honor of wearing the Olympia crown for 82. Next year's Olympia will be held in Germany, and I feel that we have seen the last of many of our familiar champs. If not, then it'll be interesting to see who will compete in 83. Zane, Coe, Beckles, please don't retire. After all, Chris did it, didn't he? Note, this was the first time that the Olympia was judged by using a placing system. Each man was assigned a placing, which was added together. The lowest score would indicate a higher finish, which is unlike previous scoring where the highest score usually would win. All right. Great article by Gary Bartlett. And I got to agree with Gary on his assessment of the competitors. I think everybody agrees. Samir and McAway and Casey were the three best guys in condition. All right. Now I got another article for you here. And it says, Chris Dickerson wins the 82 Olympia. It was the happiest day of my life, says Chris, and a great day for bodybuilding and the IFBB. And this was written by Bill Dobbins for the first issue of Flex Magazine, which was the April 1983 issue. Who do you think will win? All of us involved with Flex and Muscle and Fitness magazines were asked in the weeks before Joe Weider sent us to London to cover the 82 Mr. Olympia. From the answers, it's clear that nobody was very certain how the show would turn out. Tom Platz, who many felt would have won the show the year before, was frequently named favorite. But Frank Zane was known to have spent the entire year in preparation for the Olympia, and Frank Zane is almost always the man to beat whenever he competes. Albert Beckles had guest posed at the World Championships in Bruges, Belgium, and had looked fantastic. Beckles was another bodybuilder who always posed a major threat. Yet Bertel Fox would be in the show, too. If Bertel had benefited from his experience at the Night of the Champions and learned how to get cut up without losing muscle mass, he might well be awesome. Chris Dickerson, well, he was up in Oregon training with Bill Pearl, and certainly he, too, was a top contender. But many felt that 1980 had been his year, and Arnold had taken it away from him. He had seemed unenthusiastic at the 81 Olympia, and he might simply have lost the psychological desire necessary to dominate his opponents in 1982. Which just goes to show you how you can know so much and still know so little. Chris Dickerson, it turned out, had not only not lost his desire and drive to become Mr. Olympia, but had refined and tuned it to perfection. He was so prepared, both physically and psychologically, that he managed to do what Frank Zane has always said was necessary to win a title like this. He had become Mr. Olympia even before stepping on stage, and was able to project this image so strongly that the judges and audience had no choice but to accept its inevitable reality. Of course, this wasn't immediately obvious as we all arrived at the hotel before the contest. What was clear, looking at the faces of the various competitors, was that most of them were really ready. Everywhere you saw that competition mask, that visage created when you have virtually no subcutaneous fat at all, when the skin becomes drawn tightly across the face, the cheekbones, the jawline. There were, of course, rumors and speculation. Samir Benoud had been giving private posing exhibitions, and witnesses claimed that he was in the best shape of his life. Fantastic. This claim turned out to be true, and Samir would end up placing very well in the upcoming event. Casey Viator, himself ripped and in great shape, several times seemed disoriented and confused, which led many to think that he wouldn't be able to handle himself properly on stage. This turned out to be totally wrong. Casey would prove to be a considerable force once the 1982 Olympia got underway. The atmosphere surrounding the entire affair was British and very low-key. No crowds of admirers mobbing the hotel lobby, very little electricity and tension in the air. The weather was cool and rainy, and the mood of the hours before the contest somehow totally in tune with the weather. Round one. But all this changed as the competitors stepped out on stage for the prejudging. The audience was everything you could expect for an Olympia, all reserved, thrown aside, enthusiastic, and expressive. The first round comparisons began, and the fans shouted out encouragement to their favorites. Right away, you could tell that Chris Dickerson was the best he had ever been. Upper body bigger and thicker, hard and defined, with no signs of the lack of proportion he's been accused of in the past. His only problem was a large bump on one elbow, which he later said was a calcium deposit. Frank Zane, on the other hand, looked a little strange. His vascularity was outstanding, as was his symmetry. Well, we are talking about Frank Zane. But he didn't seem to have that perfection of shape so characteristic of his physique. He didn't look hard. His thighs seemed too small, and he looked very tired. But if Zane was somewhat disappointing, there were always Samir Benoit and Casey Viator. Samir was indeed in fantastic shape. His body, he had explained, tended to retain too much water. So he consulted with an endocrinologist to find a remedy. With the water gone, he was finally able to stand on stage and threaten his competitors with one of the most aesthetic physiques in bodybuilding. Casey was muscular and huge. Joe Weider likes to describe certain physiques as Herculean, and there is no word that better expresses how Casey looked. Even standing relaxed, his lower back was not only defined, it was striated. Tom Platz, unfortunately, hadn't hit it just right for the contest. Rumors that he had torn a bicep had been confirmed, but his arm didn't look that bad on stage. He looked somewhat blocky and smooth, however, with none of the quality that had won him so many admirers the year before. Albert Beckles also wasn't in his absolutely best shape, but he was pretty close. Standing next to Johnny Fuller, who was ripped and hard as a rock, Beckles lacked a certain degree of muscularity, but his fantastic shape was very evident. A contender, certainly, but probably not destined to win tonight. Muhammad Makawe, in the words of one onlooker, appeared to be a perfect little man. Standing next to Chris, who's only 5'6", he looked diminutive, but the aesthetic quality of his physique, his shape and proportion, and his outstanding definition made it difficult to find any fault. The contest was judged using the placement system instead of the now discredited point system. Each competitor was placed first through 16th by each judge in each of the three rounds, with the high and low scores thrown out in each round. The top six were scored again in the same manner during the final pose down. An examination of the score sheet reveals that at the end of round one, most first place votes went to Zane, 3, and Dickerson, 3, with Frank winning the round 9-10, the low score being the best in the placement system. Most of us watching the contest and not privy to the scoring would have probably been surprised to find that Zane had done so well. One first place vote went to Tom Platz, also a decision difficult to justify. Casey Viator did very well in round one, coming in third. The fact that he was so muscular and striated while simply standing relaxed was a great factor in his favor. Also, his outstanding weaknesses isn't his physique, but his posing, and no posing was necessary in round one. Samir might have done better, but as ripped as he was, there was still something soft about his physique. This was less apparent later in the show when he posed, but it was very evident in the first round. By the end of round one, it was apparent who was and was not going to be a factor in the contest. Bertil Fox was very smooth and overweight. Yosip Wilkos, while somewhat better than last year, was not likely to place as high as he did in Columbus, where he got sixth. Boyer Coe didn't even look good enough in shape to be an exhibition. Danny Padilla, in his quest to get ripped, had come in looking slight and skinny. Dennis Tenorino, in fantastic shape, had not improved upon those weaknesses he's always shown in the past. Jacques Neuville wasn't in his best shape, or he wasn't in bad shape, but he was simply outclassed in a contest of this caliber. Lance Dreher, with a physique impressive enough to allow him to stand on the Olympia stage, wasn't in shape. He wasn't nearly as good as when he won the heavyweight class in Cairo, and he probably should have made up his mind to get in shape or stay home from this Olympia debut. Roger Walker, a bodybuilder of great potential, apparently never even tried for this one. Maybe living in Australia, so far away from the rest of the world of professional bodybuilding, just puts him too far out of touch. With Makawe and Johnny Fuller, it wasn't easy to make an assessment. Makawe had no real faults except his small size, but in a show like the Olympia, that could be an important factor. Fuller was huge, ripped, and vascular, but many judges simply don't like the shape of his physique and what they feel are unaesthetic qualities. Round two. Round two belonged to Chris Dickerson. His arms, always criticized as too small, were so developed with splits in the bicep and all sorts of subtle contours that sheer size became irrelevant. And as always, his execution of the poses was totally competent. Chris earned 5 first place votes in round two, and he clearly began to pull away from the field. Zane and Viator each got 1 first place vote, but Casey earned 12 points to Frank's 17 points to shade him for second place. Samir was close behind with a score of 19 points for the round. Round two showed a number of things. It revealed, even to those who had been believers in round one, that the Frank Zane on this stage was not the same as the man who took the Olympia title in 77, 78, and 79. It also showed that Casey Viator, who once professed to dislike posing and rarely practiced, had been working hard on displaying his muscularity properly. He still seemed somewhat tentative and awkward, as if he had to think hard about what he was doing, but he was getting the job done. Round two also confirmed that neither Bertel Fox nor Tom Platz, with their overwhelming muscle mass, had achieved the kind of condition that would allow them to use their development effectively. Strangely enough, Johnny Fuller, who appeared so tremendously muscular in round one, suffered in round two because as he hit his shots, not only not much happened, he was only slightly more muscular when posing than he was just standing relaxed. Albert Beckles, however, looked good posing and improved his score over round one by 5 points. In one particularly exciting moment in the round two comparisons, the judges called out Beckles, Fuller, and Fox, three British bodybuilders, and the crowd went wild, cheering and clapping. In one comparison, McAway was called out to stand between Beckles and Viator, two giants by comparison, and he managed to hold his own, looking in some ways better than the other two. Yet the judges continued to overlook the Egyptian throughout the contest. In round three, the theme that had been established in rounds one and two was carried to its conclusion. Posing to a slow and very grand musical selection, Dickerson produced an enormously effective routine. He combined traditional poses with a number of mind movements, stimulating drawing a bow, for example, or pulling a heavy rope. Zane had an elaborate multi-part routine worked out. The first part was typically Zane with many of his most familiar and effective poses. The second part used a lot of quick movements, very unlike what Zane normally does. That part of the routine, frankly, didn't seem to work very well. However, unknown to the producers, the speakers on stage had been disconnected, and the bodybuilders could hardly hear their own music. That certainly didn't make Zane's task any easier. Samir did a graceful and effective routine. However, toward the end, unhappy about not being able to hear his music well, he stepped to the side of the stage and complained to Oscar State, while the judges were still evaluating his performance. Realizing his mistake, he jumped back on the platform, and he gave the audience a few more poses, but that loss of composure couldn't have done him any good. Beckles produced his expected professional routine. Tom Platz, clearly a favorite of the English audiences, ended his routine with his famous leg shot, and although he wasn't in his best shape, those quadriceps still popped out, as did the cross striations that are his trademark. Casey Viator posed to the music from Conan and once again showed that his posing, while still not on par with his competitors, like Dickerson and Zane, is much improved. But even with Zane's posing excellence, Casey was able to tie Frank in round three. Boyer Coe, incidentally, as badly out of shape as he was, still managed to put on his usual exciting and imaginative posing routine. The other competitors may not have been taking notes as he did a series of innovative moves, including feigned boxing punches, but perhaps they should have. The pose down. The six pose down finalists were Zane, Benute, Dickerson, Beckles, Platz, and Viator. At the end of the pose down, when Tom was announced as six, there was some booing, but Tom raised his hands to quiet the audience and the boos subsided quickly. And there was to be no repeat of the huge negative reaction that accompanied the announcement of the winners the past 2 years. Beckles finished fifth, only 2 points ahead of Platz. Samir was fourth, unhappy with not doing better, but satisfied to have shown himself to be definitely in the top ranks of the international professionals. Casey Viator, too, was not totally happy when he was announced as third. He probably felt he should have beaten Zane, an opinion shared by many others. He did, in fact, receive 2 first-place votes in the pose down, compared to only 1 for Zane. Nonetheless, Casey had definitely made his presence felt. If he can continue to come into contests in this kind of shape, he's certainly going to win his share. With just Frank and Chris on stage, you could see that Zane really felt he had a chance. Pam Meister, covering the contest for NBC, had said earlier that Frank had told her he knew he wasn't in his best shape. Nonetheless, this close, after winning the title 3 times before, you could tell he wanted it. But it was not to be. Chris Dickerson was the winner. Frank Zane, the very gracious second-place finisher. Chris started smiling and probably didn't stop for several days. He told the audience and NBC that this was the greatest day of his life, but that he was retiring from competition. Hindsight. Afterwards, the contest postmortem went something like this. The consensus would have had Zane finishing lower, with Viator and Benute finishing second and third, and with McAway and Fuller ending up ahead of Platz. But this opinion comes from these same people who totally failed to predict the outcome of the show in the first place, so take it for what it's worth. The contest had some production problems. More production people should have been working backstage, dealing with the television crew, the sound crew, and so forth. Also, the sound equipment used was the auditorium PA system, which lacked both volume and quality. You should be able to do more than just hear the music. It should affect you emotionally. Also, with England's strange rules and customs about bar and restaurant hours, there was no place to get anything to eat between the end of the pre-judging and the start of the evening show. This was very inconvenient for many hungry bodybuilders. However, David Riley, who promoted the Olympia along with Oscar State, was very eager to find out exactly what we thought could be improved in the contest production. He and Oscar worked very hard on the show, and they plan to do more shows in the future. Whatever mistakes occurred this time, Riley assured us, would be corrected next time around. So who won the 82 Mr. Olympia? Maybe we all did. Believe it or not, there was one individual sitting right by the stage who started screaming things like, "Oh no, not again. They should never hold another Olympia," when Chris Dickerson raised his hands in victory at the 1982 Mr. Olympia contest in Wembley, England. But he was about the only one. November 13th should be recorded as the day credibility was restored to the Olympia. No matter how you feel about the last two Olympias, whether you agree that the winners were deserving or not, it's clear that the degree of controversy these events generated was extremely harmful to the sport. But there can be no complaint about Chris Dickerson in 1982. He was in the best shape of his life, his upper body bigger and thicker, balancing his lower body to perfection. He was cut and defined with none of the drawn or depleted look that mars the performance of bodybuilders who diet unwisely. His posing and stage manner were elegant and controlled. He treated the contest as if it were an exhibition, the audience there simply to see him perform. Yet there was no arrogance in his presentation. He seemed to be enjoying the show immensely and to be very happy being there. There was one heart-stopping moment after Casey Viator was given third place when Chris and Frank Zane stood alone on stage. You could hear a murmur go through the crowd. The incomparable Zane, three-time Mr. Olympia, was simply not at his best this particular evening. As he stood next to Chris, this was evident to virtually everyone. And yet Zane had the name, the reputation. Would the judges go for Zane for the wrong reasons and once more cast grave doubts on the credibility of the Olympia and therefore the fundamental structure of the IFBB? There was an audible sigh of relief when Zane was named second. The system worked. The judging process was vindicated. Thank the efforts of Ben Weider and the IFBB Judges Committee, the careful supervision of the judges by Oscar State, the use of the placement system instead of the discredited point system, or perhaps all the above. Frank Zane, being the total professional and fine gentleman that he is, accepted his defeat with good grace. He congratulated Chris and raised Chris's hand in victory. Zane, of course, has no need to prove anything. He has been a champion in the past and will no doubt be so again. But the audience that left the Wembley Conference Center that night had seen a victory for an entire sport, not just for one individual. It was clear that nobody had won on the basis of a name, political connections, or past performance. Not that those things had clearly happened in the past. There are many who would deny it. But now there was virtually unanimous endorsement of the outcome and the promise that old wounds could now begin to heal. Chris Dickerson may have won a contest, but all of us who care about bodybuilding won something even greater, a new credibility and a renewed hope for the future. All right, so that was interesting that this was the first Olympia where they used the placement system. And of course, the point system was regarded as one of the reasons why they had such controversial decisions in 1980 and in 1981, although it had worked well in the past when Frank Zane was winning the Olympia. And even before that, I can remember the placement system going all the way back to 1975 when Arnold won the Olympia in Pretoria, South Africa. So the judges for this contest, they have the score sheets in this article. The judges were Julian Blumhardt, Roger Schwab, who we've had on the show many times, John Martin, who I believe was from England, Walter van de Breyden, who I also interviewed on our podcast, if you want to go check that interview out. Walter was from Holland, I believe. Doug Evans was from Wales. He was also a judge in 1981 when Franco won. Ludic Nosek was from Czechoslovakia, and he was kind of a controversial judge. I'm going to talk about him in a second. And Winston Roberts was judge number 7. He was from Canada. So looking at the score sheets, Dickerson got only three first place votes in the first round, and Frank Zane got three first place votes as well. Zane got a sixth place vote from Winston Roberts, and Dickerson got mostly first, seconds, and thirds. Casey Viator got an eighth from Doug Evans and a sixth place from Ludic Nosek. But he got a couple second places, third places. He got a fifth place. Now, Samir, I want to talk about Samir. Samir has talked about this on interviews. In the first round, which was a symmetry round, which, of course, Samir was known for, but as they mentioned in the article, he did look a little soft. Samir got a seventh from Julian Blumhardt, fourth from Roger Schwab, and Roger said on our show that he should have placed Samir higher. So he had Samir at fourth. He got fourth from John Martin. He got fifth from Walter Vanderbraden, fifth from Doug Evans. But here's the controversial one. Ludic Nosek put him in ninth in the symmetry round. And Samir had an altercation with Ludic Nosek at a contest after this. I think it was at one of the Grand Prix shows in 1982, once Samir found out that he was placed ninth by Ludic Nosek. Now, it didn't affect the final placings because they crossed out the high and low scores, so that ninth place was crossed out. But that was unbelievable that he put him in ninth, especially when Samir was in such great shape. Tom Platz got a first from John Martin, who was obviously thinking Tom was in his 1981 condition and ninth in his 1982 condition. Mohamed Makaue got some really crazy scores. Julian Blumhardt, who's usually a great judge, had him in 12th. That's unbelievable. And all the judges marked him down. Even Roger Schwab had him in 9th, and Roger regrets that, as he said in our interview. But yeah, he got 12th, 9th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 8th, and 9th. So not one judge had Mohamed Makaue where he should have been placed. In round two, which was the compulsory poses, Dickerson really stood out. He got five first-place votes, and Zane only got one, and Casey Viator got one. And Casey did really good in that round. He got 12 points, with the low score being higher, and Zane got 17 points. Zane actually got a seventh, but from Winston Roberts. And he got a first from John Martin, right? Is that right? Yeah. And then our friend Roger Schwab had him in second. So Roger had Casey in first. He had Frank Zane second. He had Samir in third. He had Albert Beckles in fourth. And he had Dickerson in fifth. So that's interesting. McAway, his scores improved a little bit. He went from a final score of 48 to a final score of 37 in round two. But he still got a 12th from Julian Blumhardt. I wonder why Julian Blumhardt put him so low. He got a 12th. He got a 6th from Roger Schwab. Another 6th, a 7th, a 10th, an 8th, and a 6th. So he was still placed pretty low. And then in round three, and it's interesting, too, at these Olympias back then, nowadays they don't do the posing routines until the night show. But back then, and this includes the Olympias that were held in Columbus, they would do all three rounds. They would do the first round, which was standing relaxed, the second round, which was the compulsory poses, and then the guys would come out, each guy would come out one by one and do their posing routine to music in the prejudging. And then at the night show, they would repeat that posing routine to music. So it was kind of anticlimactic. They would do it twice. They would do it at the prejudging and at the night show. So if you saw the prejudging, you basically saw everything. You saw both two rounds of judging, the standing relaxed and the compulsories, and you saw the posing. And they did that when I went to go see the Olympia in Columbus in the late 70s as well. And they did it in 1980, and they did it in 1981. So in the third round, which was the posing round, Dickerson again dominated. He got all first place votes and 1 second for a total score of 5. So that's like a perfect score. And Zane got, looks like, 3 second place votes, and he got 2 fifths. Julian Blumhardt had him in fifth, and Walter Vanderbraden had him in fifth. And Winston Roberts had him in ninth. Wow, Winston really had Zane low, but Zane was not at his best for that show. Casey tied with Zane in the posing round. He actually got a first place vote from Walter Vanderbraden, and our friend Roger Schwab had Casey in fourth place. And then Samir did much better. He got 19, but he was still placed seventh by Ludic Nosek. So Ludic Nosek had Samir. He must have had something. against Samir because he had him in ninth in round one, which was a symmetry round. He had him in sixth in round two, and he had him in seventh in round three. But his scores were crossed out because he gave him the worst scores. So Samir had 19 in round three, 3 points behind Casey and Zane. And McAway, I want to see what McAway plays. So McAway, again, was placed 12th by Julian Blumhardt. I'd love to know why Julian Blumhardt did not like McAway. He had him placed really, really low. He had him in 12th. Two judges had him in 6th, including Roger Schwab had McAway at 6th, though I know he regretted that decision looking back. He got a 7th and an 8th. So, yeah, McAway just did not get any respect. It's interesting they had three Grand Prix shows right after this Olympia. The week following, it might have only been two Grand Prix shows, and McAway won both shows. So he beat all these guys. Zane did not compete. Dickerson did not compete. But Casey competed, Samir competed, and McAway beat all those guys. So he did get redemption right after this contest. And, of course, the next 2 years, in 83 and in 84, McAway placed second. So he was, and he also won other shows. So he was finally awarded his due. So in the pose down, only the top six were placed. Dickerson got 1, 2, 3, 4 first place votes, 2 second place votes, and a fourth place vote by Julian Blumhardt. In fact, I'll read what the judges placed them all. So Julian Blumhardt, judge number one, had Casey in first. He had Albert Beckles in second. He had Samir in third. He had Dickerson in fourth, Zane in fifth, and Platts in sixth. And then Roger Schwab had Casey in first. He had Dickerson in second, Zane in third, Samir in fourth, Beckles fifth, and Platts in sixth. Judge John Martin had Zane in first. He was the only one to put Zane in first. He had Dickerson in second. He had Samir in third. He had Platts in fourth. He had Casey in fifth and Beckles in sixth. And then Walter Vanderbrayden had Dickerson in first. He had Casey in second. He had Samir in third. He had Zane in fourth. Platts fifth and Beckles sixth. And then Doug Evans from Wales, who had some controversial scores the year before in 81. He had Dickerson in first, Zane second. He had Tom Platts in third. He had Samir in fourth, Casey fifth, and Beckles in sixth. And then Ludwik Nosek, the famous Ludwik Nosek. Guess where he had Samir? He had Dickerson first, Zane second, Casey third. He had Beckles fourth, Platts fifth, and Samir in sixth, of course. He really had it out for Samir. And then Winston Roberts, the judge from Canada, had Dickerson first. He had Beckles in second, which is weird. He had Casey in third. He had Samir in fourth. He had Platts in fifth. And he had Zane in sixth. He did not like Zane at that show. So pretty interesting. Interesting stuff. Did compete in next year. Samir won. And Zane took fourth. And that was his last Olympia. Dickerson did not compete the next year. He retired at this contest, but he came back in 84, and I think he only took 11th. That was a mistake coming back. Casey did not compete. He did not compete in the Olympia again, I don't believe. He didn't compete in 83. He didn't compete in 84. So Casey had the momentum going after this contest, but he never followed up on it. And Samir, of course, won the Olympia the next year in 83. Where did Beckles place the next year? Beckles kind of placed low, I think, in 83. It was like 7th or something. And Platts, weirdly enough, did not compete in 83, but he competed in 84. What he should have done is he should have gotten his bicep fixed and then came back in 83 in top shape. So that was weird. Tom tore his bicep, like, I think, 4 to 6 weeks before the contest. He did not get it fixed. He competed instead. He waited several months before he finally got it fixed. And by the time they fixed it, it never was the same. It didn't look the same. I know with the bicep tendon, when you tear it, it will recede up the arm if you don't get it fixed right away. And Tom made a huge mistake not getting it fixed. He should have just obviously sat out the contest and not competed in 82 and then came back in 83. And McAway, as I mentioned, this was the beginning of his really great career in the professional ranks because he took second the next 2 years. All right, so that wraps it up. Great reminiscing about the 82 Olympia. Chris Dickerson has passed on. Casey Viator has also passed on. So we lost two great champions there. Frank Zane is still with us at 80 years old. Samir, of course, I do the podcast with him every week on the Muscle Maturity Podcast, Old School Labs on YouTube. And Albert Beckles is still with us. And I also noticed that Gary Bartlett got Albert Beckles' age right, 46. He did not say that he was 52, which many people would believe if you believe that Albert was born in 1930. But we know Albert was born instead in 1938. All right, guys, that's it for the show. Hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week. I will be in Maui next week, but I will be back the week after. And if we don't get Jerry back on the show in time, I will be back on the show. Maybe we'll read some old articles, as one of our listeners mentioned. I think that's a great idea. So have a great week. Enjoy your workouts. Keep training hard. Stay safe. And we'll see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Take care.